Hi, this is Doug Podell. Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. Don't forget, while you're online, to check out the Riff Concert page. It's the Motor City's best for complete rock concert information. For more details, just click on the Riff banner on your Windows Media Player.
...of oil profits. Rather than going to the hands of stockholders, we're going to be helping the people of the United States. We'll talk about that as well. Hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving. I did. Got together with my family. Had to do more driving. Whew, man. Yeah, it was all right. Roads weren't real bad. Hit a few ice storms, what have you. But I guess a lot of you just getting back. In fact, some people said they're going to be listening on the way back from the airport. So greetings to you all. And although we broadcast primarily in the Detroit area with also our Canadian friends in southern Ontario and also in northern Ohio, we're on the internet at WRIF.com, also through radiopower.org. Tomorrow, you FX probably about 4 or 5 hours from now, you can pick this up on iPod by, you can go to my website or you go to WRIF.com. That's the easy way to do that. It'll all be archived at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Find out, if this is all going by too fast for you, you can just go to my website, PeterWerbe.com, PeterWerbe.com. And there's a microphone up on the left. Get it? Yeah. All right. Click on that. It'll give you all the info. Pardon me. All right. Also, it's a phone-in talk show, so I haven't even start talking about anything, but we're always open line, so if you want to discuss anything, if you'd like to start in, 313-298-WRIF. We also take emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Well, it was Black Friday on Friday. This is, of course, now we've learned that that day is supposed to send a lot of retailers into the black, into the area of successful profits. And people were out, but not quite to what they thought. In fact, let's see here. ShopperTrack, which measures purchases at 45,000 mall-based merchants, found that sales for the day after Thanksgiving fell almost 1% from last year to a measly $8 billion. I wasn't out there. I never shop till I drop. In fact, I rarely shop. I mean, another, I guess, strike against me. Not a model citizen. Right? I don't watch television. I question authority, and I don't shop. Imagine if everyone did that. Well, if no one shopped, this economy would be in real trouble, wouldn't they? If everyone lived, well, this sounds a little boastful. Sorry about that, but I don't know. I started. I'll go on. I mean, I'm not much of a consumer, and I kind of have almost everything I want. I'm saying because I'm thinking that may sound like either I'm very wealthy or I'm very arrogant, or something like that. But affluence, if you think of the word, people say, well, he's very affluent. They usually mean he has a lot of money. She has a lot of money. But what it means is satisfaction of needs, and there's not a lot out there that I'm really dying for. I know, and I know many of you listening probably have a lot you want for your kids, stuff you want for yourself, presents you want to buy for others. But in the latter category, presents, what I've done, in fact, no more presents, no more ties, no more soaps, no more pears. You know, I know folks, in fact, the people, this is probably a shock. I know there's some people in my family that are going to be thinking, oh, Peter's going to be sending me the usual pears. No more pears. It's all going to peace and social justice groups. So what you do, and of course, since Hurricane Katrina and Rita, I've been sending money like this to Food Not Bombs. That's foodnotbombs.net or, commongroundrelief.org. Commongroundrelief.org. I think those are on my website. And so what I do, as I say, we have contributed, we never say how much, but we usually think, how much are we going to pay for a present to dad or sis or, whoever. I mean, they have names, but my family all likes to remain anonymous, okay? Anyway, so it might be $50 or $25 or something like that. Or if there's a number of people, you'd probably spend $5 or $10, kind of send that in a group because you don't want to send. I mean, it's all right. They'll take $5. But if you're going to send them money anyways, you might as well let it get up to $20 or $30 or $40. So that's what I've been doing. But that doesn't help the retail stores, does it? Let's see, the drop. Okay, so there was a drop of 1% since last year, contrasted sharply with rosy reports from discount chains with locations outside the malls. Walmart reported that a record 10 million shoppers had walked through its doors before noon on Friday. Now, I saw some footage. Some of you may have seen that. In fact, I didn't watch television. I saw this online. It was from a television station, but a lot of people looked like when they opened the doors of Walmart that people did not walk through the doors. They stormed through the doors. They trampled people. People got in fistfights and stuff like that. It was a pretty ugly scene at a lot of Walmarts. And one of the criticisms of the giant Walmart chain that are made particularly in the Robert Greenwald's film, Walmart, the high cost of low price, is that they have such bad security. And there's this incredibly high number of crimes that take place on a regular basis in Walmart parking lots. But this was all, they had the TV cameras there saying, oh, the joyous shoppers, tis the season to be jolly. And people are slugging it out and trampling elderly women and all of that, all so they can get a bargain. But I don't think we talked about that last week, did we? The Greenwald film, Walmart, the high cost of low price. I don't know, maybe some of you don't have a bad opinion of Walmart just because, they offer low prices. I mean, forget about the sweatshops, the anti-union stuff, the foreign undocumented workers they chain inside their stores and all of that. They give low prices. And ultimately, hey, why pay X when you can get X minus, with X minus being at Walmart? That's kind of odd that they're, I think they're, let me see, I had it here somewhere, but I think their sales were up. So this film, Walmart, the High Cost of Low Price, that had 7,000 screenings, an anti-Walmart film, didn't do very much. I mean, Walmart really got panicky. They started a fear and smear campaign about the film against Robert Greenwald. But it didn't seem to hurt him too much. And I don't know how many of you saw the film. And I did. And there we go. It was well made. It made the point that no matter how bad you thought Walmart was, when you start hooking all these things together, because you get little scattered reports that the Justice Department fined them, that they found out that kids were doing unsafe work. And just, right now, I can't remember it all. But when you see the film, of course, I saw the film, so I don't have much of an excuse. But when you link it all together, it's a pretty awful corporation. Sort of on the other end of things is Costco. They're also a discounter like Walmart, big box store and all of that. Except they don't mind if their employees unionized. A lot of them belong to the Teamsters. Their wages are almost twice what the Walmarts are. And I mean, they offer great health plans as opposed to Walmarts, which is just absolutely terrible. And why? I mean, here the owners, as I've talked about so much, so many times before, now I'm forgetting, let me see, what would that be? I think they're the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th richest people in the world, the 5 heirs of Sam Walton, the founder. So between the 5 heirs, they have more money than Bill Gates. And yet still, they create sweatshop conditions in other countries. They pay terrible wages. They give terrible health benefits. And, what's so interesting about this, and one of the things, the subtitle of Robert Greenwald's film, Walmart, the High Cost of Low Price. By the way, you can go to walmartmovie.com, and see all about it. Is the high cost of low price. So you go in there, you go, whoa, this is so much less than wherever, the neighborhood store or another chain store or something like that. For instance, the wages are so low, the health benefits so bad, is that, I think it is, half of the employees the people that are waged, they're so low on the scale that they have to get on public assistance like Medicaid. So we're paying that. And the people that are thinking, oh, we're going here because we're getting low prices, they don't factor in that cost of it all. The other thing, one of the people in the film made the point, which I thought was excellent. I never thought about this. Walmart is essentially China's U.S. distributor. Walmart is China's U.S. distributor. And the person speaking in the film, not not the narrator or anything, but just one, I think it was from some family that was getting driven out of business by the Walmart competition, is he was saying that without Walmart, that Chinese manufacturers would have to go to a mass variety of distributors and wholesalers and companies and what have you. And they still do that to some extent. Obviously, Chinese products are sold all over. But the biggest purchaser of Chinese goods is Walmart. And the effect they have, I mean, this is the first time since probably the 1880s when John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil could operate in this manner. And remember, we called him and people like him robber barons. What they can do, usually what happens is a distributor comes to you and you say, I can make this widget and I'll sell it to you for whatever. It's the opposite here. Walmart goes to manufacturers and says, we will pay you X amount if you can do it. Can you do it? And in order to get these contracts, of course, in Central America and China and what have you, they go, yeah. And that means the low cost has to come out of a lot of people's hides in those third world countries that are doing the producing, because they have to work in sweatshops. And sometimes then Walmart will come back to them and say, we want you to lower your price to us, which means they have to get more work out of the people that are already there. They're already working in sweatshops. They're already getting miserable pay. So it's terrible. What that also leads to is something, again, a high cost of low price, is the balance of trade. If you know what that is, you know, I mean, in other words, the United States buys about $6 worth of goods from China for every dollar that we ship to China. And that has a negative effect on the economy over the long run. And explaining it way too long. Nobody, including Bush Co., wants there to be a negative balance of trade. In fact, he was talking about Bush, when he was over there, was talking about that with the president of China. Let's see. With American imports from China climbing at a clip of nearly 30% a year, American exports to China would have to nearly triple each year just to keep the deficit from widening further. So when you hear deficit, you know that has to be paid off. A deficit is a debt. We're a debtor nation, and a lot of what we pay in terms of our taxes doesn't go to help us, our communities, our schools, our kids, our responders to crises, anything like that. It goes to pay off the interest on the debt that we're paying back as a nation. This is what Bush Co. has driven us into. I mean, it doesn't matter for all his corporate buddies. They're doing just fine. Right now, the United States is on track to hit a record $200 billion this year. Yeah. All right. So, I don't know. I didn't shop till I dropped. I rarely shop. And I was thinking again, too, this is just a self-description and not saying how cool I am or anything like that. But I guess I can't even think. If someone said, all right, you can go in Walmart and walk, or any store, walk out of there with whatever you want. I don't know, nothing even, you know, what is it, visions of sugar plums danced in their head. Huh. I wouldn't mind a sugar plum or two, whatever the hell those are. Sounds good, though, sweet. 313-298-WRIF. And, like, no, electronics? No thanks. What is that thing that just came out you can play games on? No interest. And I was thinking, didn't I mention him? A friend of mine that has this extraordinarily expensive sound system. Huge speakers and all tube, which turns out, I guess, to be better, all tube preamps and amps and some of this stuff, which is 30 years old, which turns out to be best and all that. And I guess, yeah, I mean, I would take it, but my little, and he's got like a $2,000 or $3,000 turntable. I got one bought one for $350. I'd take that, but I'm not longing for anything. Watches? I hate watches. I took a trip. I remember last February I went to Cuba. I said, I got to have a watch. I got to know what time it is. So I went around. I looked at watches. I'm thinking, $9. I don't want to pay that for a watch. So I wound up finally getting a watch for $4.95. And I look in the New York Times, other that have watches. You know, they're like $4,000 and $5,000 for watches. I don't think so. Cars? I got one. I don't know. So, I mean, I don't have any real big wants or desires. Am I missing something? What it maybe, you know, again, if you're not on the high end of the financial pile. You could be saying, geez, I'd like some clothes for my kids. I'd like to have dental care for myself. I'd like to have, I mean, I can think, you know, if you're not positioned well, I mean, I'm kind of on the fortunate side of things. But I don't have a lot of stuff. I mean, I am low on the stuff level and kind of always have been. I mean, I don't want any, I mean, I got enough clothes. In fact, you know, every once in a while, my wife would come back and say, hey, you know, I was at the mall, I found these shirts. You know, and so, but now I got too many shirts. I got more shirts than I even need. So anyways, but am I missing something? Tell me. You tell me that. And are we going to be able to be buying a lot of shirts with GM cutting 30,000 jobs, closing factories, Toyota? See the news in the Free Press today? Where is it? Thing here. Relentless. Toyota poised to overtake General Motors. Here's the scariest part. Now it's stepping on the gas. Well, yeah. They, let's see. Their profit was almost $11 billion in this year. They got $28 billion in cash and marketable securities on hand. They spent $17 billion on capital expenditures. The value of their combined shares are more than 13 times General Motors' market value, $177 billion. Where did I just see this? Something about they were talking about the eclipse of the U.S. I mean, down the drain. Remember I said that before, when you go from a republic to an empire. I mean, it doesn't even look like we're going to be able to go to an empire. All of Bushko's schemes just crashing. And they're about to surrender, which I'll get to in a little bit. 313-298-WRIF. Let me, maybe I should do this. All right, we'll do Venezuela. Not Venezuela, I was just told. Venezuela. I better learn because I'm going to Venezuela. I'm going to be traveling to Venezuela. That's what I like to do. That's what I'll consume. Trips, travel, you know, forget $5,000 watches, at least for me. And so it says Chavez sends heating oil to poor in Northeast. Does this everyone know this? In Caracas, Venezuelan, no Z sound, Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez strengthened his Latin American ties with generous oil deals that he is now extending north to the United States with plans to ship cheap oil, heating oil, to low-income people in New York and Massachusetts. Now, I think this is already happening. When is this from? It would be nice if it had a date. Well, yeah, November 26th. Venezuela's Citgo Petroleum Company. Citgo? Sound familiar? That's right. There's something like 1,700 Citgo gas stations that retail Venezuelan petroleum refined into gasoline. Made a symbolic first delivery to a Boston area family this week. Shipments are due to reach tens of thousands of families starting next month, and hospitals, homeless shelters, and other facilities in needy communities also are in line to get oil. Chavez's critics call it a political stunt aimed at needling President Bush, a constant target of taunts from the leftist leaders. Others say Chavez is likely to win praise from some Americans with a clever approach that bypasses Washington to make his point. It ever occurred to anybody or the writers of this article that maybe he's just helping people? I mean, what does he stand to gain by needling President Bush? I mean, you see how low his motives are ascribed? I mean, he doesn't care about the poor people. He doesn't care that in the richest country in the world, people can't afford heating oil, that gasoline prices are so high for many of our working poor that it's hard, that it almost costs them an hour's wages to get to and from work. So it's a political stunt. Why is it a political stunt? Let's see here. Larry Burns, who I've interviewed on this show, director of the Washington-based Council on Hemispheric Affairs, says, how are you going to retaliate for keeping people warm for the winter? Linda Kelly of Quincy, Massachusetts, said she feels grateful to Chavez for the fuel that her family of five received this week at a 40% discount. Kelly said he's doing the right thing. The people of Venezuela are lucky to have him. That's what the government is supposed to be about, taking care of the little guy. Well, of course, Linda Kelly of Quincy, Mass., not in our country. Governments in this country are about taking care of the big rich guy. That's what Bushko is all about. It's a little different in Venezuela. And for this, of course, Chavez gets criticized. Awash in oil profits. Chavez says he is leading a socialist revolution and calls his program an act of justice for poor Americans whom he says have been neglected by the U.S. government. Well, what's wrong with that? That makes sense. That's true. Chavez has called Bush a madman. That's intemperate. I mean, there's a big guy in the North, and they're sharpening the knives in Washington circles and in the Pentagon. Believe it. Believe that they have an invasion plan. Well, I've told you before that the United States military has an invasion and occupation plan for every country in the world, including Canada, dear Canadian listeners. Washington denies such plans. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he said Venezuela must be prepared to repel a U.S. attack. If necessary, Washington denies such plans, but has accused Chavez of endangering Venezuelan democracy and destabilizing the region. They say that all the time. They never quite say how. Oh, my Lord. Citgo has 13,500 independently owned gas stations. I was way wrong there. Venezuela has sent extra market price oil shipments to the United States after Hurricane Katrina to help areas where Chavez accused Bush of not doing enough for survivors. Well, that's what most Americans think as well. But here, just one other piece as well. Now, what is this from? SMH.com. Anyway, Venezuela's president, listen to the language here. Hugo Chavez has pulled off his greatest public relations coup yet in his campaign to irritate the Bush administration. Now, Chavez has spread a lot of this wealth to the Venezuelan poor, has made incredibly generous deals with the countries of Caribbean nations. So why is this a campaign to irritate the Bush administration? I mean, usually anybody that criticizes the U.S. is simply portrayed as a nut. And somewhere in here, to the anger of many in Washington, Citgo Petroleum Corporation, a company controlled by the Venezuelan government, will supply more than 45 million liters of oil at 40% discounts below market price. So I can't remember what the hell liters are. Isn't there about 4 liters in a gallon? So that's like 10 million gallons of home heating oil that are needed by poor people in this country. And the market in the United States isn't filling the gap. Certainly, Bush Co.'s government, aimed only at the rich, isn't going to do it. So it's left to a generous man from a generous country populated by generous people. Isn't that a better way to say it? The deal is one of the most spectacular moves yet in Mr. Chavez's attempt to market his 21st century socialism using his country's oil. And while it may not change many minds in Washington about his populist and autocratic regime. Populist, remember, we looked that up in the dictionary, and populist means anti-corporate. That they think the people ought to be the central focus of government policies and program. What a radical! How crazy this man is. Where, of course, I mean, did they ever say... where is it? Bush. President Bush, how would you put that? His corporatist government. That's what you say. Bush's corporatist government. Anyways, on and on and on. So I'm off to Venezuela myself. He's not all good, Chavez. He's saying he wants to start a nuclear energy program. Bad. Very bad. Very bad. One other note, let's see, I have time. I'll do this quickly and get to your calls right away. 313-298-WRIF. Big article in the New York Times today in the travel section by Luisita Lopez Torregrossa. Oh, man, I got to practice my Spanish. It's so bad. My apologies to you people that speak Spanish or Hispanic. It's called Waiting for Havana. And on the front page of the Times today, it said, oh, I forgot the language, but something about that Cuba returning as an American playground. So I was down there in February this year. Incredible country. Here it says, Cuba with a magnificent, unspoiled beauty seduces in many ways. Yeah. To American business executives, it is an untapped market of 12 million people eager for American goods. To American hoteliers and cruise ship executives, it represents a tantalizing glimpse of the future. Yada, 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 like that. And Kirby Jones, president of the U.S.-Cuba Trade Association, the travel industry is sitting on the last virgin territory in the entire world. Americans want to go there for the same reason that dozens of companies around the world have. There's money to be made. Well, when I, the logic is that when Castro passes away, that then everything will fall apart. I have no idea whether that's true or not. I asked a number of people when I was in Cuba whether they thought that. The people that were kind of running the party lines, the mechanism, the structures in place, and whoever, you know, somebody else will replace them. I mean, maybe that's true. I have no idea. Other people said, quien sabe. Who knows? Who knows what's going to go on? But here's what I predict. Just like East Germany went from a communist totalitarian police state to a wreck of an economy and, you know, this massive rise in unemployment and crime and what have you, pretty, that's what will happen in Cuba as well. It'll wind up like Jamaica. It'll be a democracy, but of course there'll be rampant poverty with a wealthy class. It'll be overrun by Americans, and it'll be like it used to be, an American playground, just like it was in the 40s and the 50s. It was America's whorehouse. It was America's gambling den. You could go there and see, you know, play the casinos, go see a live sex show, and you know, the mafia will be back. Maybe they'll even go back, you know, like some capitalist concerns said, hey, the communists took our stuff back. Maybe the mob will go back and demand its, you know, its property back. The government that Castro took over for from, the United States-supported Batista regime, was much worse than the Castro government ever has been. All right, so that's my that's how I consume, I guess, travel. We'll talk about some of these other things, including Bush's surrender in Iraq. That's probably a little tantalizing, but we will get to that. All right, people are listening all over the country, so our first caller is calling from Colorado. It's Russ. Russ, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're listening to Night Call. 313-298-WRIF is the phone you called. Thank you and welcome. Let's see. Oh, is this one of these things? Yeah, let me see. What did I do wrong here? Russell, are you with me? Boy, this does not seem like it's on. Hold on. Let me put you on hold. All right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to just... Man, this is weird, because I should be hearing a dial tone right now, and I'm not. Okay, let's think this through. Maybe what we'll do, we'll go to our commercials, and in the meantime, so hang on, call up, too. Although, hey, speaking of Castro, I may have to give like a three-hour speech like he does. I hope not, because I want to get you on the air.
This is WRIM.com. The lowdown on the hottest concerts in town are only a click away with a singular wireless concert connection. Log on to the concerts page right now at WRIF.com to find out where your favorite bands are appearing live in concert across the Motor City. Keep it right here on the Riff for your chance to text in to win tickets, backstage passes, autographed rock merchandise, and more. Exclusively on your singular wireless phone. The singular wireless concert connection from Singular Wireless, raising the bar at 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks. Rock, rock, rock.
101 WRIF and Media Play present the Free U College Giveaway. Use your MasterCard or complete an entry form at Media Play, and you can win a one-time payment of $150,000 towards college tuition. No purchase necessary. Ends December 31st, 2005. Open to U.S. residents 18 or older. For rules and alternate entry details, visit your Media Play store today or log on MediaPlay.com or WRIF.com. Media Play with locations in Livonia, Utica, Taylor, Clinton Township, and Ann Arbor. Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391. You're listening to WRIF.com. And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsor, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. On 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Why? You know, well, let me tell you first what we've been talking about. Some about the fact that now Venezuela, led by Hugo Chavez, is sending low-cost fuel oil to the poor of this country, also to homeless shelters and places like that. And, of course, the press can't just say, thank you, it's a publicity stunt, Chavez is a populist, which I thought is good. He's a populist, Bush is a corporatist, which is better. 313-298-WRIF. Also, shop till you drop. We were talking some about that. I said I wasn't much of a consumer. And I said when I went to Cuba in February, I had to buy a watch. So I paid $495. So I'm not giving the credit. He says, I thought you were against low prices. Now, this is one of the few remaining people that still support George W. Bush, majority of U.S. adults. Now, check this commie paper that I'm quoting from. A majority of U.S. adults believe the Bush administration generally misleads the public on current issues, while fewer than a third of Americans believe the information provided by the administration is generally accurate, according to the latest Harris poll. This is from the Wall Street Journal, you know, who love Bush because, of course, he sends all this cash towards their readership, you know, the ultra-rich stockholders and what have you. A large majority, 68% to 28% of Republicans say the Bush administration generally provides accurate information. 91% of Democrats say that the information is generally misleading. 73% of independents. So they're in a polemic against reality. I mean, they're hanging on. When you see these people with still that have these Bush bumper stickers, I mean, don't you wonder, who are these people? I mean, what more do they have to learn about the lies and the corruption? I mean, how many, there's a lot more indictments coming, so maybe that will shake them. But aren't they just a little embarrassed?
Hi, this is Doug Podell. Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. Don't forget, while you're online, to check out the Riff Concert page. It's the Motor City's best for complete rock concert information. For more details, just click on the Riff banner on your Windows Media Player.
You know, they've gotten really away from what Sam Walton based the company upon. And it's just, you know, they're really coming from the evil empire. I mean, they don't really care about the employees at all. They work the managers to death. And it just, why do Americans go and support them? I'm like, I don't. I mean, I go to the regular stores and pay a little bit higher price, you know. I mean,
that's hard for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard for a lot of people. I mean, even if they have feelings about Walmart, if they pay $10 more. And also, it's kind of a class thing. Like Costco, I was mentioning earlier, and they pay good wages and stuff like that. That's a lot more middle class and upper middle class. And Walmart tends to a lot to be the poor and the working poor and the working class as well that are waged so poorly that it's the kind of deal where I'm sure a lot of them just say, well, I've heard bad things. I know they're squeezing people in other countries. I know they're anti-union. I know the people here, they're forced to smile even though they're getting treated like crap. But, hey, I don't have enough money to get what I need for my kids, and I got to go to the, you know, the people that are charging the least.
Do you think the president, United States should step in and do something about this? I mean,
we just
don't care about have we got to the point that we don't care about a fellow American?
Well, I think that's the case. I mean, certainly the people in power don't. And there's all sorts of ways to regulate commerce. And that was done, remember, from history in the 19th century, there are all the people, the robber barons, who said they could do whatever they want and charge whatever they want. There's a famous saying from a book called The Octopus by Frank Norris. Anyways, I had to read it in high school. And I remember this phrase from it when they asked how much were they going to charge. And they said, all the traffic will bear. I mean, this was like prices, railroads charging high prices. And, they'll just see what they can squeeze out of us all until we start standing up en masse. And that's not happening. I mean, most people are PO'd. And you mentioned gasoline prices. And, Russell, it's like you set me up because you're going
to
be up.
Well, yeah, I'm not trying to set you up.
Here's the way you're going to set me up. You know, I'm going to have an interview at 1 a.m. Eastern time, which is, 11 o'clock your time, 11 p.m. your time, with a whole conversation interview about gas prices. Yeah, we're getting absolutely gouged, and that could be stopped as well. All these CEOs from these oil companies got in front of Congress and lied their ass off. And there was are they unstoppable? Is Walmart unstoppable? Well, the tendency towards, here talking in economic terms, the tendency of capital is towards monopolization, which means that the small elements in a market get driven out by larger combinations. And I said this before, eventually there could be one company in the world called International General, right?
Right.
That could maybe even supplant nations because the big corporatists, they don't care about all this funny stuff about patriotism and our nation. That's for the rubes. That's for, you know, when an American puts his hand over his heart, sees the flag, and gets all dewy-eyed. The big capitalists, you know, they're just counting their money.
Do you think, it's obvious, when Bush, the gas price went to $3 a gallon, before the hurricane even hit, they're the gas companies were raising it 10, 15 cents a gallon before they even knew what the real damage was. And, you know, the Congress or Bush didn't even step in and do anything about it. I mean, that they had to tell, you know, the American public that, hey, hero, don't care a squat about us.
Well, they don't. And one of the only way they're going to see that, the only reason they're going to care about us is if we make some noise. And so far, that the only formal opposition, which is a phony opposition, is in the Democratic Party. That's really just along for the ride. Now, they used to be kind of co-partners in crime, but now they're just kind of drifting along, hoping maybe Bushko will do so bad. In fact, they are, that if we just hang out, maybe we'll get we'll get the presidency back in the Congress, and then we'll. What are they going to do? They haven't made any promises yet. All right, Russell, I got to move on. Thanks for joining us from Colorado.
Have a good night.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. 313-298-WRIF, a little closer to home. Here's Ken in Waterford, Michigan. Ken, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Doing great. Thanks.
Yeah, just wanted to comment about you're talking about Walmart and, you know, how they run their corporation. And I've been working for Meijer for like 13 years. And it seems like in the last 2 years, the way they've been doing business and running their company, that, you know, they're pretty much getting things more to where they're like, they're being ran Walmart, too.
Well, you guys are union, aren't you?
Well, yeah, it is union, but, I mean, realistically, I mean, if you look at my contract, it's like Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
I mean, lots of loopholes around everything, but, I mean, it's like holidays, you know, it's like they're cutting wages or they're cutting hours in all the departments. And yeah, it just seems, you know, more and more like they want to get as much as they can out of us. And yeah, I mean, technically we have a union, but it's like they don't really do much for us.
Well, oftentimes, you know, unions, depending on the situation, are very weak. Well, I mean, I'm sure you've heard, or you may not, I don't know, the phrase called race to the bottom. Well, when a company like Walmart leads with the policies that they have in place, which essentially is attack on our standard of living and environmental standards and everything under the sun, attack on unionization, well, then other companies in many ways are almost forced to follow this. Now, for instance, I mentioned Costco before, which has a fairly strong unionization, good wages, good health plans. The CEO, who I'm trying to remember this article, makes several hundred thousand dollars. The CEO of Walmart made $27 million last year. Now, I mean, think about this. They've got a million employees. I mean, this guy could make, say, $2 million a year and have everything he wants and have that $25 million split among employees or buy health plans for him. But again, I mean, it's this almost pathological greed that the CEO wants more income than he could ever consume. So it's not even about consumption. It's not about getting an island or getting an $8,000 watch or whatever the hell these rich people want to show that they're rich, or, you know, $4 million house. You could get all of that with a couple million dollars a year. The rest is just taken directly out of the lives of people that are forced to work it under those conditions. Now, Costco has a real good medical plan and a number of other benefits. I don't have all the information in front of me. Wall Street pressures Costco to reduce benefits to its workers so that its stock will be more attractive in the stock market. Yeah. So the people that are the analysts for Wall Street want Costco to give its workers less of a deal. They want to force the company Costco to reward workers less so that that their stocks will be more saleable. So we're living in a system that actually rewards greed and disadvantages people like yourself and the others who work their butts off.
Oh,
I mean, that's the sad story.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, I work two jobs just to make ends meet, and you know, I got a little bit of credit debt, but it's like if I really wanted to live comfortably, you know, I make about probably $35,000 a year between both jobs. and it's like my health benefits are going to. Next April, they're gonna become even worse than what they are now.
Yeah. See, as far as I'm concerned, that's criminal. I mean, if we live in the wealthiest country in the world, why is that necessary for anyone to have, to have to work two jobs? You know, one of the things that that costs employers so much money. For instance, GM is always bitching about having to pay so much for its health care. That it's a private health care system. Well, I mean, why wouldn't they want a national health program that, a good one, the best in the world, that's available to everyone as a matter of a right as a citizen, and then suddenly the cost to General Motors of health care would be like their plants in Canada, like zero. Wouldn't that make a lot of sense? Yeah, but maybe that'd make too much sense.
Yeah.
Well, good luck on it all, man. But I mean, they're pushing us too far. I mean, we don't have a coherent, organized response. I mean, they're the wealthy, the corporations, Bushco et al. They've declared class war on us, the middle class, the working class, the poor, and we're getting our ass kicked royally. This can only go on for so long. I mean, sooner or later, it's going to be no more Mr. Nice Guy. All right. Thanks a lot, Ken. I appreciate your call. Good luck on it all. Man, that just makes me so angry, all of it. Here's Alan Engster. Al, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF.
Well, I called up originally to talk about our earlier attempt to have a coup against Hugo Chavez.
Yeah.
But listening to your last caller, I want to give him some advice.
Sure.
But he needs to do it first off using the UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers. Avoid his union leadership, get a hold of his friends, other people that feel the same way he does, and what they have to do is start, you know, forming small groups and start doing what they call work to rule, you know, where you just do your job.
Sure.
They ask you to do something extra? Nope. Get me a committee man.
Yeah.
You know, then they have to, you know, they have to form a small group themselves because the union isn't really going to back them. One of the things I studied was UFCW with Myers and their organization there. The union's not going to back them, so they have to form their own small group inside that store that will work to get, you know, whatever they want done.
Well, I think that's going to start happening. And, you know, this is the kind of ideas that are starting to percolate up through people's minds. I mean, think about how people were under the thumb of the corporations and owners.
Well, even nowadays, though, you're not only under the thumb. A lot of the unions have become so weakened and craven that, you know, they're not.
Right.
You're getting shot at from both sides.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and so a fire's got to be lit under their butt, or, as you're indicating, finding other ways to circumvent anyone who is in the way of social and economic justice. And it turns out to be our unions. I'm a union member, and my union does all right by me, but it's, you know, it's a different kind of industry.
Mine doesn't do all right by me. I make single digit wages with no health insurance. I just sat through Thanksgiving holiday, took 2 days off without pay, and I still have to pay union dues.
Yeah, that sucks pretty bad, I'll tell you. All right, well, we got to get ready for some response. I mean, we're just retreating. All right, Al, thank you very much. Talk to you, man. Let's see. Dan writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Most of the gas prices in this area are at about $1.99, Westland and Romulus, Michigan. And while it's still high, it's a lot better than when Katrina and the hurricanes hit. So what do we do? Just demand that it goes down to 10 cents per gallon? Hey, why not? I'll tell you, Dan, Hugo Chavez says he could provide gasoline to the United States for a dollar less a gallon. So in other words, about a dollar a gallon if it wasn't for what he calls the speculators and the middlemen. I think that's the case. Rod writes in, I think what they, the Myers and Walmart, are doing, what they're trying to do is convert the American workers into a sweatshop-type situation. Do you think? Yeah, of course. Let me just real quickly give my other economic lesson for the day. There, one of the things, well, let's go back to unions. A union that unfortunately now is small and weak, but has a grand and glorious history. The Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW. So their nickname is the Wobblies, but they never wobbled when they were fighting their strikes. They were big, 70, 80 years ago. And they're still worthwhile now. I keep thinking about joining them. But anyway, I mean, you can do that as an individual. You can go to IWW.org. They have a constitution. A preamble to their constitution says, right at the beginning, the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. And they go from that. Now, you go, oh, that's too radical. Oh, yeah, that sounds like communism or something un-American. Hey, the working class and the employing class, the capitalist class, the ruling class, whatever, the elites, whatever you want to call them, they believe that. They know they have separate and distinct interests from the rest of us. They know that they want to maximize profits and they want to keep wages down. That's called, well, let me go to the economics lesson. There's two types of capital. Fixed capital, which they cannot control. Well, Walmart does. Fixed capital is what the stuff you have to buy. They have so much power they can actually demand, as I said earlier, that what is sold, they can dictate the price at which stuff is sold to them. I mean, this is extraordinary power. They can actually affect fixed capital. But the other capital is variable capital, and that's you and me. Our labor is sold as a commodity, right? So how much are you going to be purchased for, you working thing, you or me, working thing? And it depends on lots of stuff. Part of it is supply and demand. You know, these right-wingers and conservatives are always talking about the free market. You don't want your labor subjected to a free market, or we're all going to be making $2 an hour or less. I mean, that's what they'd like, and that's what the one person was writing in their message, that we'll all be down to sweatshop wages. And that's beginning to happen, spiraling downward, this race to the bottom. And the wealth is all there. The world keeps accumulating more wealth in the aggregate, but it's shared less and less. So that the people that control the wealth and accumulate the wealth do so on the basis of the labor they buy from us, our labor, our lives, our time. And it's variable. So what we can do, see, like in China and Indonesia, Central America, their wages are controlled by the market. So that's why they make 80 cents an hour or something like that. We have artificially, through unions and through legislation and stuff like that, driven the price of labor up. So we're getting more than if there was just a free market for our wages. So what's happening is as Bushko and others begin to destroy the unions, the legislation that's protected our standard of living begins to drop. As globalization takes over and we are going to be pitted directly against people making the lowest wages, you can see where this is all going. It ain't pretty. But as long as they're the only ones participating in class warfare, I mean, it's our butts. Now you can say, wait a minute. I was just out in Birmingham, Sterling Heights. I was just down, in a shopping mall in Westland and places like that. Man, people were driving up in new cars and people were spending away. Well, forgetting even about the level of debt that exists. Credit card debt, personal debt at all-time highs, foreclosures at all-time high on homes and all of that. There's going to be a sector of the population, maybe the upper third of us, that are going to be well-waged. So the rest of us are going to be the ones that are going to have to live in straw huts, if you will. All right. Let me just get one more call in. Here's Amanda calling in from Jackson, Michigan. Hi, Amanda. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. I just want to tell you that I love your show. I look forward to hearing it every Sunday.
Oh, good. You got rid of Ted Nugent from Jackson. You're lucky.
Yeah, I really.
Is he really living in Crawford, Texas?
Something like that, yeah. But he still has his ranch there, though, like his hunting ranch, so.
Yeah. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to call and say my mom, she is a teacher, and she has MESA, which is, according to her, one of the best insurances.
Uh-huh.
And they were going to take that away from them, so they had to bargain to keep it. And the bargain was that they opted to not take a pay increase to keep their insurance.
Huh.
which, you know, really stinks because they don't get a cost of living increase or anything. They just are stuck with what they've been making in order to keep their insurance.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things happening is that we find that municipalities and states and school districts have less and less money. I mean, we suck this enormous amount of tax revenue out of the citizens, and rather than going to provide people that are so important to our society, like teachers, with a decent standard of living and health care and all that, it goes down the drain in Iraq or down the drain to Halliburton and what have you. So, again, if you know, if we're just kind of see it as bad weather, you know what I mean? If we just say nobody likes it if we're going to have a picnic and all of a sudden it rains, you go, oh, shoot, it rained. Well, this is very specific public policy that your mother's being ground up under. And, I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not there. We don't know what to do tomorrow. Sometimes people get shocked when they say to me, what should we do? And I go, well, I'm not 100% sure. And they go, whoa, wait a minute, dude, aren't you on the radio? Aren't you supposed to have all the answers? Well, I mean, it's pretty easy for individuals to see what's wrong. I mean, you can see that. But how we can correct it in a system that is so locked into this, you know, these unfair, discriminatory and reckless attack on our standard of living, that's a whole other thing. You know, I gotta run real quickly and do my spots before midnight here. So thank you, Amanda.
Absolutely. Thank you, Peter. Have a good night.
Thank you very much, and we'll be right back. Please join us.
This is WRIM.com. Tired of expensive phone bills? Standard phone service can cost a minimum of $30. And for the unlimited packages, it's anywhere from $40 to $70. After adding all the taxes and fees, the question is it really worth it? I'd like to introduce you to Corecom's new product, Voice over Internet Protocol, or simply VoIP. This innovation allows you to talk to anyone around the world by using your broadband internet connection. With its advanced features, VoIP is revolutionizing telephone service as we know it today. Even more exciting is that this can all be done at a fraction of the price of traditional phone service. Why would you pay more when you can pay less? If you've got high-speed internet access, Corecom can offer you a package for as low as $15.99 per month. When was the last time your phone company offered you any package options that low? As an added bonus, if you call within the next 10 minutes, Corecom will throw in 1 month free. All you have to do is call 1-866-680-CORE. That's 1-866-680-CORE. Call now and mention promotion code WRIF, or if you register online, type in promotion code WRIF to get your free month. Corecom, revolutionizing phone service, one call at a time.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
Hi, this is Colleen McDonald, president of Holiday Automotive Group. You know us as Holiday Chevrolet in Farmington Hills, Livonia Chrysler Jeep in Livonia, and Century Dodge in Taylor. We know it's never fun to have to bring your car in for service, and worse yet, if you've been in an accident. But rest assured, our service staff is here and ready to help you. To make an appointment, go online at weloveholiday.com. It's that easy.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
We also have special discounts if you need body work on your vehicle and accept all insurance companies. Call us at 866-867-0909 for more information. We're the Holiday Automotive Group. We've got you covered from Downriver to Oakland County.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
You're listening to WRIF.com. On the riff, then why not get your riff rock to go? Download all your favorite riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com. Riff Rock. Rocks. Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock. The way you want it. Double rock.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Riff Rock.
was rated one of the most out-of-shape states in the country.
Really?
MichiganStepsUp.org is the two-step program to losing that title, my friend.
Steps?
Move more, eat better.
It's that easy.
Hi, Tom.
Oh, hey, Tina.
Looking good. How about a walk at lunch?
Sure. So, what was that website again?
MichiganStepsUp.org. Move more, eat better. Repeat. A message from the Michigan Department of Community Health, the Office of the Surgeon General, and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome to our second hour. Remember, at 1 a.m., we'll have two interviews about the price of gasoline. Are we being gouged? Is that a question? Of course we're being gouged. We'll be talking with Tyson Slocum of Public Citizens Energy Program. And also, this is not in front of me, Richard Heinberg. Yeah, who writes about oil, peaking oil. Oil, you know, we're almost at the point where we're got it almost half out of the ground. Now, I did say, in fact, I should do this. I did say I was going to talk about Bush's surrender in Iraq. Remember, that's what they were saying. All these liars that lied us into the war in Iraq, that told fib after fib. I mean, can you imagine how indignant Cheney is? Yeah, he's calling everyone reckless and just all these. And, you know, it really is. Remember that? What was that little thing when you were a kid? I'm rubber, you're glue. Everything you say about me bounces off me and sticks on you. I mean, that's exactly what was going on. Everything that Cheney was saying about the critics of the war that now use the L word, liar, right? I mean, I lost stations on my national broadcast, my nationally syndicated show, when I was calling Bush and Cheney liars like in 2001 and 2002. Now everybody calls them that. And even worse, the former CIA director, he called Dick Cheney a vice president for torture. I mean, he's the guy that put into practice all these torture policies that have made the United States a torture state, a rogue nation, if you will. Now, a week ago, that John Murtha of Pennsylvania, an ex-Marine, 37 years in the Marines, a Vietnam veteran, decorated, they started calling him that he was advocating surrender because he said immediate withdrawal from Iraq. He compared that horrible person, what's his name, Scott McClellan, the spokesperson for Bush Co., they compared him to Michael Moore. I mean, by me, that's a compliment, but you know, they don't think it's that. So they go on and on. You know, we're not going to withdraw, and Bush is mourning the fallen troops in his address, talking about sacrifice. Can you imagine this? I mean, Bush talking about sacrifice. And how many of the Bush clan of people eligible for fighting are part of the Iraq Fighting Force? Yeah, you got it. You know, there's about 30 of them. Zero. I mean, it's for somebody else to do the killing and be killed. Okay, and then also, you know, these people that are still running around with Bush stickers on, they're talking about, we're not going to cut and run. And in Crawford, there was this, like, a dozen people supporting Bush today, and they're saying, Americans don't wimp out. We're talking about policy here. We're talking about probably the most dramatic decision a nation can ever you know, carry out, war. And these people say, we don't wimp out. It's done like it's like a football game or some interpersonal dispute, as opposed to thousands and thousands of people dying, hundreds of billions of dollars of our national treasury being wasted and what have you. Americans don't wimp out. Well, you know what? They're wimping out. They're about to surrender. The United States is getting out. Just like the United States was defeated eventually in Vietnam, not because it didn't wipe out the entire country, not because it didn't kill millions of people, but because it couldn't accomplish its goal of ending the insurgency against this foreign occupation. That'd be us, you know, the foreign occupiers in both Vietnam and Iraq. But already, I don't know how this maybe went under your radar, Iraqi leaders at a reconciliation conference reached out to the Sunni Arab community by calling for a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S.-led forces and saying that the country's opposition had a, quote, legitimate right of resistance. Now, here are the people that we've spent hundreds of billions of dollars on, gone into their country and destroyed it on the basis of a pack of lies, have set up essentially this theocratic government where crime lords run city after city. And the Iraqi leaders, the Shiites, say that the United States should withdraw and that the country's opposition, read insurgents, have, quote, a legitimate right of resistance as long as they don't attack civilians. It's okay, say the leaders of Iraq, if they attack American soldiers. Some of you may have been there. Some of you may know people that are there. Some of you may have family members that are there. So our boys are saying, that our Iraqi boys are saying it's all right to resist our soldiers. The communique condemned terrorism, but it was a clear acknowledgement of the Sunni position that insurgents should not be labeled as terrorists if they don't target innocent civilians or institutions. Now, so they're saying get out. So, but we don't cut and run, right? We don't wimp out. Here, according to CNN, the top U.S. commander in Iraq has submitted a plan to the Pentagon for withdrawing troops in Iraq, according to a senior defense official. And it's all details. I'm not going to read you the whole thing. But essentially, they're talking about getting us out. Why do they want to get us out? Well, the grand plan, these morons running things in, I mean, I don't know what the generals thought. I mean, they eventually got to carry it out, so maybe they're responsible as well. But most of it lies at the doorstep of the commander-in-chief. Bush Co. Bush Incorporated, that makes moves not for anything that ever comes out of his mouth in terms of an honest statement, but rather to establish this oil empire where the United States would directly control this massive underground supply of oil. Well, it didn't work out. They didn't welcome us with flowers. There's no end in sight. The slaughter continues every day. The United States destroying town after town, killing innocent civilians. Our boys get killed. It's just a horror show. It's corrupt beyond belief. More and more indictments around corruption. And so now, beneath it all, if you get beyond their statements, Rumsfeld is talking about withdrawing. What else here? Oh, yeah. Shiite cleric increases his power in Iraq. Remember old Muqtada al-Sadr? Well, he's got this militia. I don't get into that. All right. Here, this as well. This is what we're talking about. U.S. starts laying groundwork for significant troop pullout from Iraq. Bush will give a major speech Wednesday at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, in which aides say he's expected to herald the improved readiness of Iraqi troops, which he has identified as the key condition for pulling out the U.S. troops. So these troops that weren't worth a damn suddenly are going to be, there's going to be the announcement, oh, they're wonderful. So this is surrender. This is withdrawal. This is defeat. This is what Bush Co. has led us to. These people have screwed up everything in their lives, every business they ever touched, every political system, every political institution, and now they're doing it to the entire country. That's how bad it is. And seeing all this, I think there's even one more here. Oh, yeah, MSNBC. This is in Newsweek. The new way out, U.S. leaders finally have a coherent approach. I was going to read a lot of this, but take it from the headlines. They're getting out. And when are they going to get out, and why are they going to get out? One and only one reason. They've given up totally on controlling the Iraqi government, of having it be our client state, of building a $1 billion embassy, of eventually overthrowing the government of Saudi Arabia and having these compliant client states that will do our bidding and allow great penetration of American capital with profits flowing out, even though, I don't want to get too long on the side. So that's all gone. So there's one and only one reason right now. It's called the 2006 elections, of which the Republicans stand the chance of losing both houses of Congress. So they've got to get this out of the way quick. Doesn't matter. They don't care about bloodbath. They don't care about who the hell takes control of Iraq. They're cutting and running. They're wimping out. They are surrendering. Bush go now. Not the Democrats. Not John Murtha, the decorated Vietnam hero, Bush Co. And these people still have their bumper stickers on their car. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby, and our email address is calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes. All right. My apologies to our Canadian friend that probably just didn't want to pay the bill for waiting so long. pardon me, or excuse, pardon me for the cough, and sorry for keeping you waiting. Let's go a little closer to home, Sterling Heights, and Josh. Josh, hi, it's Peter Werby.
Hi. First, before I get on my main subject, I wanted to point an article out to you since you're saying so much about the oil. I get Wired Magazine. You've probably heard of it.
Sure.
Or like a technology magazine.
Right.
Well, newest issue, the cover article is Why High Oil Prices are Good for America. Now, I felt just how you feel now before I read it, probably shocked. Like, how could they say such a thing? But they actually make a very good point about the more ticked people get about these high oil prices and everything.
Uh-huh.
They're saying about the higher these oil prices get, the more likely it is that the auto companies finally get started with these alternative fuel sources, like hydrogen fuel cells or whatnot, that if you keep these gas prices higher and get everyone ticked, you'll finally have all these alternative fuel sources actually up and running, even though we've been talking about it for the last 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, however, well, I mean, I agree that it could happen. The other thing is people drive less, there's less pollution, but unfortunately, it means that the poorest among us suffer the most. Yeah, I mean, there should be a crash program. I mean, oil, as I say almost every show, is absolutely disastrous, and it among other things, and that's one of the costs that never even gets figured into the dollar per gallon price, is that we fight these wars, we support these terrible regimes in the Middle East, so we'll have access to oil. Get off it. I mean, we could have a crash program. Declare a crisis, say that all of this country's resources should go towards finding alternate fuels. And what was your other point, Josh?
Well, actually, it goes with your last caller before you went to break. She was talking about the lack of funding in the school systems. And I'm part of Utica Community Schools. I go to Stevenson and MST, another program for, like, gifted students with math and science. But that's besides the point. Right now, we have a severe budget crisis ourselves since like a lack of funding from the state, and there's been a fight during the summer. I believe you probably heard about it, like a large rally that was at the state capitol about trying to get more funding for the schools.
Sure.
Well, right now what's happening is that the budget has gotten so bad, and we're $15 million in debt. We're the second largest school district in the state, and in Macomb County, we are 14th on the list of 15 school districts of how much funding we get per student.
Uh-huh.
And the problem is that our school board, their plan right now, that they're trying to get past everyone, and every parent in the district is absolutely pissed about this, is that they're trying to, they want to take our 8-hour day and make it a six-hour day where we're losing a class. And the make some different with the lunch. Well, anyways, everyone's losing an elective, and everyone's absolutely furious about this because it doesn't hurt me as much because I only have one more year here, but there's a lot of other kids that are, like, going to be losing a lot, and everyone's ticked. And no matter what we've done, no matter what we've said, they haven't really helped us whatsoever. Like, at all the board meetings, whenever anyone talks, they just kind of nod back.
Well, yeah. I mean, they start saying there's no money, and there has to be balanced budgets in the state, for instance. So the state has been cutting back on its contributions. So I just keep going back to the same theme. Where is all the money going? Where is the money going to the richest country in the world? Why are we cutting back on education? Why are we cutting back on so many different things that for our communities? That's a good question. All right. Thank you very much, Josh. I appreciate it. Let's see. I want to get this one email here that Robert wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Recently, a document from the United Kingdom has stated that Bushco had a secret plan to bomb the Al Jazeera network in the Middle Eastern nation of Qatar. What are your thoughts on this story? Well, it just really shows the level of insanity of Bush. I mean, he's like all upset because you actually have this this network showing what's going on in Iraq. And Tony Blair. I mean, there's this document that was leaked, I think, to the Daily Mirror, one of the papers, or the Sun. Maybe it was the Sun. And the two people that leaked it have been indicted under the Official Secrets Act. And Tony Blair had to talk Bush out of this. You know, no, we don't want to do this. I mean, this is not in Iraq. You know, Qatar is kind of out of the way. I mean, this is how loony the people are that we're being ruled by. Here's, speaking of Mount Clemens, here's Derek in Mount Clemens. Derek, hi, it's Peter Werbe, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing great, thanks.
Yeah, I just want to say I love the show.
Well, thank you.
And before I make my comment, I just want to ask you something quick, man. I heard you say you were into martial arts, man. I was wondering what style you were into.
Well, you know, I'm starting to get a little older, so now I'm doing Tai Chi Chuan, which I've done for about the last 15 years. I mean, it's supposed to be, Tai Chi Chuan means a supreme ultimate fighting style, but as most people know, it's done very slowly. It almost just looks like a meditative sort of exercise affair. Whereas, I took Muay Thai Tung Sudo for years, and I don't know what this stuff would do. Tai Chi is practiced very, very slowly because they want the positions to be extraordinarily exact. I mean, so much time is spent on, like, holding a posture and then having, you know, everything, all the principles of the discipline be absolutely 100% perfect. I have no idea what its actual effectiveness would be in combat, and probably and hopefully we'll never find out.
Exactly. Yeah, I just I started taking some Kenpo, actually, and I'll tell you, man, anybody who's thinking about going into it for the right reasons, it's great, man. It gets you in great shape and makes you feel a lot better. But anyway, I just want to make a quick comment.
Wait. Let me just one thing. Maybe this is for, I mean, I guess, I still think I'm fairly fast, fairly strong and what have you, but Tai Chi does not depend on muscles. That in fact, some of the people that are the best are a lot older, I mean, like 80, and they have, they're almost like a skeleton, yet they can employ the principles in such a manner as to absorb and return energy. I mean, it has some vague, although probably I don't think my teacher would agree at all, but it has some vague similarity to judo, jiu-jitsu, aikido. So you're, you know, that rather than meeting force directly, you know.
More submissive.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the yin, and then the yang is the, you know, the return of it. So it's, you know, it sort of takes as its symbol that, you know, that yin-yang symbol.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's actual true defense.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I just think it's an outstanding thing as far as mentally, emotionally, physically. You know, it's good cardio. It's good stuff. Somebody had made a comment on UFCW, the union. I had just a quick comment on that.
Sure.
I worked for a company, an ambulance company. I was a paramedic for 2 years. I won't say the name, but largest ambulance company in Macomb County. Anyway, 2 years I was there, and we were represented by UFCW. When I was hired in to this company, I had long hair. Okay, now I know that's kind of a little unorthodox for a paramedic, but it wasn't a problem. I worked there for 2 years. They brought in a new operations manager. He had been there for not even a month. This guy asked me, or more or less told me, you need to cut your hair, or I'm going to let you go. He wanted to run it more of a paramilitary style, and I just straight up refused. I'd been there 2 years, and I filed a grievance, and let me tell you what happened. Absolutely
sure.
Nothing. I was fired.
Oh, my God.
I was fired straight up. I grieved it three times, three meetings, nothing. They just said I was insubordinate about the situation and, you know, failure to, adapt to a uniform policy. When, number one, it was never in the union contract, and number two, it was never in the employee handbook. As far as uniform procedures, there was nothing that stated that. So anyway, I lost my job on that, and I'll tell you, it hasn't been easy finding another paramedic job after losing a job there or I did end up landing another job. But anyway, I just wanted to say UFCW did absolutely nothing to represent me. I was fired without union representation. I have some things pending on this. But anyway, I just wanted to say UFCW, they didn't do me any justice. And anyway, the guy who fired me, you were asking who these people are with the Bush bumper stickers. Well, he had one on the back, and I know who he is anyway.
Well, let me ask you one question, Derek,
go for it.
Before you go. And this is going to shock people. Now, we're talking paramedics here that are the first responders that have to be trained in, you know, someone, they have to make an evaluation of what's going on, whether it's a heart attack or a gunshot wound or whatever. I mean, extraordinarily important. Well, a friend of mine who was trained as a medic and is a Gulf War I vet, he began working at, you know, at a as a paramedic. He was organized by the Teamsters, and I thought, man, he's probably making $30 an hour.
Right.
What a jerk I am, huh?
Yeah, I was making like $12 an hour.
He was making nine.
Nine, yeah. Yeah, it's sick. You know, the only thing that's great about it is they give you a lot of overtime, and so you can make the money. There's a lot of time you spend when you're not actually out working, but when, you know, when it's crunch time, and you're expected to know your business, you know? And it's just one of those things. If you're not working for a municipality, you're not going to bring in the money. You know, it's just one of those things. You're going to have to put in the hours and hopefully be represented by some type of a union, because or a union that's worth something anyway.
Yeah, that's terrible. All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Appreciate your call. If you're dialing, hang on. Jay Hudson, our producer and phone screener, will get to you immediately. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Let's see here. So just have some patience and people be with you. There's open lines also. So you can pick those up. You know, here's one of the things that's going to happen, is happening, and I think this is excellent. A former Green Party member who advocates an immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq says he's going to challenge incumbent Hillary Rodham Clinton for the 2006 Democratic nomination for Senate in New York. That's good. Let me see it. Stephen Greenfield, he's a professional saxophone player. That's what we need. He says she's in favor of the war and in favor of continuing the occupation. Clinton voted to give Bush the power to go to war, and while she's been critical of his conduct of the effort, she has stopped short of calling for a troop withdrawal. And you got to remember, too, is that people like Senator Clinton, people like John Kerry, people like John Edwards, they knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. You know, they knew that Bush was just using all of this as this constructed excuse to go to war. I mean, why else would have so many senators and so many members of Congress voted against giving Bush this war power resolution? I mean, did Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, did he think, oh, well, I don't care about Saddam having nuclear weapons and tons of mustard gas and all of that. I don't care at all. Of course he cares. But he knew that that Bushko was BSing. And so did Clinton. And so did John Kerry. And so did John Edwards. And so did all the rest of them. No, they didn't believe that. They knew that all all this so-called intelligence, which sort of gives a different meaning to the word intelligence, doesn't it? Let me see. I thought that was in here, but there's just more and more stuff has come out from all. Remember, they said, "Oh, from the Germans gave us all this stuff." The Germans told the Bushko that this guy's lying. Curveball. Remember, all these people are dying in Iraq because of Curveball. That was the informant, a known liar. How about this? 95 bishops from President Bush's church said last Thursday, this a week ago, that they repent their complicity in the unjust and immoral invasion and occupation of Iraq. Now, what commies are these? Oh, they're the 95 bishops from Bush's church, the United Methodists. And they say, in the face of the United States administration's rush towards military action based on misleading information, too many of us were silent. Bush is a member of the United Methodist Church. The White House did not return a request for comment on the bishop's statement. Well, gee, what a surprise. Here's Dave in Westland. Dave, thanks for being so patient and for joining me at 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good evening, Pete. Peter.
Hi.
I wanted to make a comment on what you were talking about as far as Walmart earlier.
Sure.
Okay. Well, I think that Walmart, in my personal opinion, I think that Walmart is doing a very good thing for the United States. I'm a white-collar, non-union worker, and I make six figures a year, and yes, I do shop at Walmart, mainly because it's cheaper. And, you know, I have a lot of friends that are unionized workers, and I'm not talking about just your entry level. These are guys with skilled positions that are making $25, $30 an hour. And, you know, they hassle me all the time. I can't believe you shop at Walmart, and they're non-union and all this. And I say, that's why I'm richer than you are, because I'm saving money that way. Walmart, you gotta give Sam Walton some credit. You want to talk about a capitalist? He's that. He took the opportunities that are laid here in the United States and, you know, made a fortune with them. What's wrong with that? That's what I don't understand.
But I mean, did you ever go by the initials MD?
Yes, I did.
MD. MD.
So, I didn't think you were going to catch it.
I did, man. I can remember a voice from across the years. Hey, now, Dave, don't you think there ought to be some restriction on the amount of profits that people can take if it's way beyond what they can consume? I mean, these people, these Waltons are worth billions. I mean, shouldn't they be sharing a little of it with their employees?
Well, you know, I have some friends that are employees of Walmart. They're in management positions, but, you know, I don't hear any complaints from any of them as far as, even to walk into my local Walmart store. I have, just ask a few associates in there questions as far as, how your work environment is, just out of curiosity because of all these bad things I hear about Walmart. And the only thing I get back is positive feedback. You know, I had one cashier telling me, oh, yeah, this is great because they work around my school schedule and, you know, things of that nature. So I'm really beginning to wonder why there's all this Walmart bashing going around, because I tell you, I get great deals in there. I love it.
I mean, you make six figures and you bothered to go in to save a little teeny bit?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why I have money today.
Because you shop at Walmart.
Well, for numerous reasons. You know, people get rich, and believe it or not, and I'm not rich.
No.
You know, I'm not. But, I mean, people, you know, obtain wealth, you know, by cutting corners and by saving money on certain things, that there are other people that just go ahead and they just splurge on them. Well, I'm going to go to Kmart because they're union, or I'm going to go to Farmer Jack because they're union, or Kroger, and pay the extra money, and it's really not warranted, because mm-hmm. what you're doing is you're paying the wages for an organization, let's say, i.e. a union, that's not really helping people. My wife is a member of that United Commercial Food Workers, whatever the bloody hell it's called, union. And they're not, you know, look at what's happening to Farmer Jack. I mean, they've closed how many stores in the past couple of years, and they're still talking about closing more stores.
Well, I'll tell you, Dave, this is what I'm talking about, the race to the bottom. Yeah, people more and more are not going to be able to afford, companies are going to say, and in some cases it's probably true, are not going to be able to afford union wages anymore. In other words, decent wages, good wages. So, because there are other sectors of the same industry, like retail food, because there'll be other people that are paying $8 an hour rather than $18 an hour, so that their capacity to make profits by paying good, decent wages is going to be limited. Pardon me. All right, MD, welcome back to the show. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com. Every successful career has a beginning. Have you started yours yet? Turbocharge your opportunities by calling ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-903-1919.
Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. If you have an interest in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design, they teach skills that many employers look for. Most programs provide a hands-on education and can help you build your knowledge base and technical skills. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Develop technical skills at an ITT Tech and discover a whole new world of opportunity. Call now for a brochure at 1-800-903-1919. That's ITT Tech, 1-800-903-1919. 1-800-903-1919. 101 WRIF and Media Play present the Free U College Giveaway. Use your MasterCard or complete an entry form at Media Play, and you could win a one-time payment of $150,000 towards college tuition. No purchase necessary. Ends December 31st, 2005. Open to U.S. residents 18 or older. For rules and alternate entry details, visit your Media Play store today or log on MediaPlay.com or WRIF.com. Media Play with locations in Livonia, Utica, Taylor, Clinton Township, and Ann Arbor.
WRIM.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days, every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is deleted by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, so our final segment for this night, at least the phone-in segment at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm going to be airing a couple of interviews I did previously. First one, talking about the price of gasoline. I don't think it's going to be any shocker to you that we're being gouged big time by these robber barons, these thieves in the big oil companies. But he puts a face on it and tells the process and also gives some suggestions about what we can do. Now, I said earlier, I didn't come to the conclusion about it, so that's this ex-Green Party member is challenging Senator Hillary Clinton in the 2006 Democratic nomination for Senate in New York. And now, this is something that should be done, you know, those of you who work a lot in electoral politics, is there's all these Democrats that are doing nothing, you know, and run a candidate against them. I mean, put the fear of getting their cushy little job back. Tell them if you're not going to take this position, we're going to run a candidate against you in the primary, and if you win, even still, we're not going to bother to do. You know, we may come out and vote for you, but we're not even going to do that for sure. But we're certainly not going to work for your reelection because you're just dead weight. You're just dead weight. All right, 313-298-WRIF is our phone number, and let's see, I'm just going to do it on my own here. Here's Randy from Westland. Randy, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just calling about the gas prices and stuff when you were talking about it earlier.
Sure, yeah, we can take that. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Well, like you said, or whoever that caller was, I called him before, too. There's plenty of alternative fuels out there already right now. It's just there's no infrastructure, and the car manufacturers aren't making cars that burn us the fuel. Well, like Ford has announced that they're going to make 250 cars that run on ethanol by next year, but that's, you know, a drop in the bucket. But where are the people going to get the ethanol fuel at if there's no gas stations, there's no infrastructure, distribution set up? You know, it's going to be real hard for people to get it. They need to set that stuff up, too, so that you can go to a local gas station and get the ethanol fuel or methanol fuel or methane fuel and stuff. There's a lot of alternative fuels out there. It's just no one's making them and no one's, selling them. And then the car manufacturers are not making cars that run on them. But the fuels are there.
Well, again, you're absolutely right. And the technology's there. And what's not there, as you said, is the infrastructure. And that should be something, we're just leaving it to the market. They're just making Hummers. So what is really needed, that has to be mandated. I mean, this is a crisis. I mean, we're fighting wars for oil. We're polluting the environment, still burning this stuff. And if the wherewithal is to move beyond that and to make sure that we don't have to intervene in the Middle East, we don't have to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on war or give away hundreds of billions of dollars as we do in foreign aid. And instead, I mean, so this gasoline that we're consuming that we think now is $2 a gallon could cost $4 or $5 a gallon if you took in what we pay in taxes and how it's used for military stuff and foreign aid. So there's a vested interest that we all have of getting off of oil and doing exactly what you're talking about.
And the other thing I want to comment was on the war in Iraq. I think that, you know, it was wrong. I mean, it's a two-stage thing. It was right to go in there and get rid of Saddam. We should have got rid of him before, but not for gas or oil, but before his crimes against humanity, against the people that, you know. And so we should be there for the rest of the world to say, hey, look, you know, you can't do these things against your own people or other countries or anything, because he was just like a little Hitler, and, you know.
But do you remember, like, he's on trial. I think the trial starts tomorrow or something. But do you happen to remember, just from reading the reports, when he gassed that village, when his troops gassed that village? It was in 1982. And so remember who was president then?
I believe it was Reagan.
Ronald Reagan. You remember who the vice president was?
Yeah, Bush. Sometimes I say Bush was president for a lot longer because I think he was pulling the strings back then.
So, well, I don't think Ronnie was pulling too many of the strings. They were starting to loosen already even back then. But so Saddam carried out this hideous crime. I mean, he got some of the wherewithal from American and German corporations, but there wasn't a peep. In fact, Rumsfeld went over there in 1984, gave Saddam a pair of golden spurs, shook his hand, this famous shot of him shaking hands with Saddam, and there was some other use of gas. I'm kind of losing the date off the top of my head, but in 1988, the Democrats put forth a resolution condemning Saddam Hussein, and the Republicans voted it down.
Yeah, well, sometimes we keep making our own enemies. We supply them with weapons and stuff, and then sooner or later, they, you know, as long as they're complying with what we want, they're okay. Just, you know, but then as soon as they got their own plans and they turn on us, then all of a sudden they're the bad guys.
Yeah, you got it, Randy. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to John in Pontiac. Hi, John. It's Peter Werby.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Two things, really. There's only one way I can see to get off from the gasoline and onto in our current political climate, get onto the alternative fuel sources. It'd be a three-part thing, really. Number one and number two both deal with taxes. First, you got to levy a heavy gas guzzler tax against any corporation that produces or utilizes natural gas. But at the same time, you got to give them heavy tax breaks if they in turn produce or utilize the alternative fuel sources such as ethanol, methanol, or hydrogen, all of which have been experimented with and shown extremely safe.
Mm-hmm.
The third thing, obviously, you're going to have a little bit of, you know, problems with that from Big Oil. Well, you send them a memo before you do it and say, look, this is what we're about to do. You've got like 2 months to begin preparations. You know, it's got to be done. The other thing I wanted to talk about was Bush, of course. I was wondering if you might have any idea what it would take to get the UN to come in and, you know, get rid of him for us.
Well,
no, seriously.
I know. I'm just laughing at the prospect. You know, we don't need the UN to do it. I mean, we can do it. We can do it ourselves. I mean, there's the political process is there. Bush has created has committed high crimes and misdemeanors. He should be subjected to impeachment, a trial based on these lies, this fraudulence that he perpetrated willfully upon the American people, upon the Congress, and that's an impeachable offense. And, you know, they could have a trial of Saddam in Baghdad, Bush in Washington. I like that. All right, thanks a lot. By the way, let me just say something about what you were, you know, talking about taxing corporations and what have you. There's any number of innovative ways that we can circumvent the market. The invisible hand of the market doesn't always work. In fact, it rarely works to the benefit of the average person. So what's needed would be, in this case, as you're saying, some sort of creative legislation that would force these huge entities to do something not for themselves, but for all of us. All right, thank you very much. Keep on thinking about that stuff. Very important. Let's see. Here's Barry in Brighton. Barry, hi. It's you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going good.
I was calling. Don't want to get you off the subject you're talking about.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
Now, but you had a previous caller who was talking about how they were cutting his school from 8 hours to 6 hours, his classes or whatever, because they didn't have the money to, you know, keep it going or whatever.
Yeah.
A few callers ago. Well, what I want to know is I live in Livingston County, and they're building new schools left and right.
Really?
Yeah. Matter of fact, Howell has a new high school being built that's going to be ready by midsummer, I think, next year. And what I want to know is for all these counties complaining that they don't have money to run the schools they have, what are they doing building more schools?
I don't know. You know, I have to say, I don't know enough of either the economics of it or the politics of it to even comment on it.
Yeah. And another thing, you had another caller who was talking about Walmart and how he shops there and stuff. I'm sorry. I used to work for Walmart, and my wife still does. And Walmart is not what it's cracked up to be. People think Walmart's a great company. I'll tell you what. None of the employees I know at the store my wife works at are at all happy with the way things go there. So I don't think that caller really knows what he's talking about.
Can I make a suggestion to you? There, do you have a computer?
No, not right now. No, I don't.
Yeah, you're probably lucky. Never mind. But there, if you can go like the library or something, there's a little $13 video of an hour. Actually, I think it's even over an hour. It's called, if you go to walmartmovie.com, walmartmovie.com, and it gives the whole lowdown on Walmart. So I don't think everybody's quite as fooled as you may think that it's a great place. At least you sure don't get this idea from the movie.
No.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yep, thank you.
Appreciate your call. Now, MD, who called in a little while earlier, Dave from, where was it, talking about Westland, I think it was? Yeah, talking about making six figures, and he always shops at Walmart. He's called the show for years, but he takes like a couple years off all the time. And I can't remember, was it Mad Dog? Was that it? I mean, that's what like MD, people drinking MD 2020, you know? All right, anyways. James from Kenosha, Wisconsin, writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And he was saying that, you know, it's fine. Walmart is really good. Here's a message for MD to consider. Let's say MD needs a gallon of paint for a home project. He goes to Walmart in order to save $1.78 over the cost of the same paint at Eddie's Paint and Decorating, a long-standing locally owned family business. Eventually, Eddie's will be run out of business as former customers follow MD's suit. As we're often reminded by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the backbone of the American economy is small business. I'm not sure that it really is, but it would be nice if it was. Apparently, MD has no problem with contributing to the demise of the economy while slopping $1.78's worth of paint on his drop cloth. For the lower class and the poor, the $1.78 savings is crucial to survival for MD. It's chump change that reflects the greed and self-interest of capitalism. Now, what did I think about that? Oh, yeah. One of the things you got to remember that Standard Oil did under John D. Rockefeller in the 19th century, they kept lowering their prices, and driving smaller producers out of business till they finally had monopolistic control of the oil industry. And what did they do then with all their low, low prices? You got it. They raised their prices. So when all the competition goes, will Walmart keep its low prices? We'll find out. Here's Bruce, who's listening in North Carolina. Bruce, hi. It's Peter Werby. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Peter. How you doing tonight, man?
Doing great.
Fantastic. Listen, I also wanted to chime in on the Walmart thing, man, because I just, you know, I have, not to give away what I do, but I have guys that I work with that work there. Just the horrendous hours that they work and the low pay, man, is just amazing to me. It really is amazing that people, you know, absorb this and just keep moving, you know, and not speak out against it.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing, too, is that apparently I was just looking on another website that you haven't mentioned, actually, I think is called walmartwatch.com.
Uh-huh.
And on this website, there's actually like a Walmart in the news where they give you the latest stuff that's going on related to Walmart. And one of the things that's just come up, apparently, is that George Miller, a representative from California, has asked the GAO to study their that memo that was made public about them not hiring people who could be possibly sick.
Right.
So maybe there's some hope. I don't know.
Well, it's that's what we call a thin reed. You know, we need something quite grander than that. I mean, if you go back and look at these stories of the 1930s, the middle of the Depression, people are getting their wages cut, and certainly they had next to no benefits and all of that. And suddenly this militant unionism swept the country, and with militant tactics, the sit-down strike and what have you. And if the current formations that we call unions aren't adequate to the task, as some people have suggested, people have, working people throughout history, and certainly in the last 100 years, have been innovative enough to find ways to make our needs known. I mean, the power right now resides almost 100% in the hands of the employers, and particularly the big corporations. And what happened during the 30s, that began to eke away. But since the 1950s, it started to go back the other, you know, in the other direction.
Sure.
I mean, yeah,
sure.
I mean, if you see like Michael Moore's, what was the name of the first film about,
Roger and Me?
Roger and Me, exactly. And where they show Flint. And so, I mean, Flint just spiraled right down the drain. And so that can happen quickly, and it can happen to the whole country. And we're well on our way. So it's time for us to fight back, or we're going to have great parts of our country be just like Flint.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Have a great night.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks for joining us. Here is Jack. Jack's listening in Shelby Township. Jack, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good. Thanks.
I hear all these people, all these years, they're always talking about the problems. I know the problems. All these documentaries. Michael Moore. Michael Moore don't care about you. He wants to feather his own nest like anybody else.
Mighty, you're being pretty cynical. I
know I am, because, you know, Peter, I spent 10 years trying to get an idea across to you American people, and you won't listen.
Wow.
I wanted to put it in a book. A book. They won't even talk to me on the radio, the news, the TV, because it's against corporate America. The only place I can give my idea out is hopefully you, or maybe stand on a street corner 24 mile in Van Dyke with a little sign.
Well,
hoping somebody will read it.
Wait. You know, I'll tell you, Jack, they're just a friend of mine visiting, who's a publisher. And it used to be a publisher was a rich man that owned a big firm, because the whole idea of typesetting and printing facilities and binderies and what have you, that was real tough. They now have this stuff called print on demand. And for hundreds of dollars rather than thousands or tens of thousands or more, I think under $500, if you have a manuscript, I mean, it used to be called Vanity Press, and even that costs you sometimes thousands of dollars. But this way, you can take a manuscript, send it into them. It's got to be, you know, electronic file. And you can get as many books as you want. Now, before, to have an economy of scale, you'd have to have like 1,000 books, so that'd be a lot. And you think, well, how the hell am I going to get rid of 1,000 books? Well, you can get them in increments of 25. And sometimes, you know, depending on the size of the book, it might cost you, for 25 books, it could conceivably cost you, you ready for this? After the first setup charge, which I think is only 100 bucks, is like $50.
Yes, so, Peter, I know all about that. I'm not in the book business. I'm just saying that I resorted to the book form in order to get my idea out, because nobody will listen. They all want to talk about the problems. Do you understand? If we continue to talk about the problems that I know about, people would ask me, they'd say, have you seen Michael Moore's film 9/11? I'd say, I already know all about George Bush. What do I want to spend 10 bucks learning about what I already know? But I got a solution for you Americans. I got a solution for the world. You won't listen to me. And all it takes is two things, unity.
Yep.
You've got to have unity.
Yep.
If you don't have unity, you go on with your sapsucker life until you die. I don't care. I only called your show today because my conscience is telling me to do it. I look at the people as being docile. They don't care about each other. They, you know, the new saying in America is, I got mine, screw you. In God we trust, bullcrap. In credit we trust. In the plastic we trust. That's what America's all about. So it kind of takes a man like me and makes me cynical. Do you people want help? Do you really want help?
Well, wait, Jack. Do you have access to the Internet?
Yes, I do. That's a good idea. Now, right there, the computer. Maybe people will listen on the computer.
Well, they do, and that's the new source of information. I'm going to have to go because I've got to end this part of the show right now. But please, go to my website, peterwerby.com, PETERWERBE. Again, the last name is WERBE.com. I don't know if that's an idea of a type of site. You've probably seen enough websites in your life. And they're actually pretty easy to construct yourself. I do all the work on it. And not all. Some people do other stuff. But anyway, It also contains how to get a hold of me by via email. So do that as well, because I'd like to hear your idea. All right, Jack, but I got to go right now. Thank you very much. Let me just take a look here. Yeah, I thought maybe I could spend a little more time. But unfortunately, that was my last caller, so my apologies to those of you stuck on the line, and thank you for having called. But stay tuned. We'll talk about gas prices.
This is WRIF.com. The lowdown on the hottest concerts in town are only a click away with a singular wireless concert connection. Log on to the concerts page right now at WRIF.com to find out where your favorite bands are appearing live in concert across the Motor City. Keep it right here on the Riff for your chance to text in to win tickets, backstage passes, autographed rock merchandise, and more. Exclusively on your singular wireless phone. The singular wireless concert connection from Singular Wireless, raising the bar at 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks. Rock.
101 WRIF and Media Play present the Free U College Giveaway. Use your MasterCard or complete an entry form at Media Play, and you could win a one-time payment of $150,000 towards college tuition. No purchase necessary. Ends December 31st, 2005. Open to U.S. residents 18 or older. For rules and alternate entry details, visit your Media Play store today or log on MediaPlay.com or WRIF.com. Media Play with locations in Livonia, Utica, Taylor, Clinton Township, and Ann Arbor. Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391. You're listening to WRIF.com. And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Well, I was driving to work, and I went by my neighborhood gas station, and I thought, whoopee, it's down to $2.01. And I was very happy, very pleased, pulled in, filled it up, and I thought, good, everything is right in America. But then I remembered what I had said on previous shows, and I had predicted, remember that? I said that gas is probably going to go up to about $3 a gallon, and then they're going to crank it back down to $2, and we're all going to say, oh, all right, everything's okay. So I guess I was right, but I don't know why I didn't pay attention to my own words. Joining me to talk about this in a little more detail, with making a little more sense of it, is someone who we've had on the program any number of times to talk about energy issues. It's Tyson Slocum, and Tyson is the Research Director for Public Citizen's Critical Mass and Energy and Environment Program. And Tyson, welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Peter.
So I told somebody here at the radio station that I was going to do a show, and they said the same thing. Well, what's the problem? The gas prices are dropping. So do we still have a problem?
Oh, of course there's still a problem. I think that this is a trend we've seen over the last couple of years, Peter, where you see very big spikes in the price of gas. Then several weeks or a month later, prices drop slightly, but never back below the amount that it was before the big spike, and then they'll spike up again. And I think we're going to see prices spike again this winter. And, of course, then there's prices for natural gas and home heating oil. I think that in addition to the high gasoline prices, I think that there are going to be thousands of people in Michigan who will not be able to afford to heat their homes this winter. So this still is a big issue. It's still relevant to talk about, especially when you look at the record profits of the oil companies, because it's a no-brainer that there's a direct connection between the record profits and the record prices that consumers are paying.
Now, it in a lot of ways, it ought to be blatant on the face of it that we're getting gouged. For instance, and I don't know anything about the actual prices, but if it costs something, one of the companies like ExxonMobil, a dollar to get it pumped out, and then they want to make a dime profit on a gallon, and the price is $1.10, but then if everything else goes up, say to doubles, and it's $2, then they'd put a dime on it, and it would be $2.10 a gallon, right? Not $3.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, the profits that the oil companies have been seeing at every stage of their production have been at record high levels. So, this is definitely something that's directly related to actions by the oil companies.
Well, tell us a little about the profitability. I think we've seen a lot on television, but it might do well to review it. How, when we talk about super profits or gouging, what are we talking about?
What we're talking about is oil companies, because of all the recent mergers that we've allowed, and because there really is no government oversight over the industry, the ability of oil companies to exploit the market to price gouge Americans is very easy for them to do. And that's been documented in numerous federal government investigations. The United States Federal Trade Commission did a major investigation back in 2001, and they found that oil companies were intentionally manipulating the Midwest market, which was leading to higher prices. And then the research arm of the United States Congress, the U.S. Government Accountability Office, did a major report back in 2004 and found that all the recent mergers have increased the ability of oil companies to price gouge Americans, and that's directly led to higher gasoline prices. So those are the investigations. And the proof is in the bottom line, the fact that oil companies every quarter seem to break their previous quarter's record. So in all, the five largest oil companies operating in the United States have recorded $280 billion in profits since 2001.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. That's $250 billion. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that eventually and essentially comes out of the pockets of the individual consumer. And as you were talking earlier about citizens in Michigan not being able to pay oil bills in order to heat their homes, those price raises fall the hardest on the poor. In other words, if you're middle class, kind of you grumble because you know you're getting hit and you're taking a little bit. But so it makes sense. The poorer you are, the more you have to spend on energy, the more it hurts you and your family.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why we saw some efforts in the Senate, a bipartisan group of Republicans and Democrats, seek to enact a windfall profits tax on the wealthiest oil companies and use the new revenue to provide direct financial assistance to low-income families through the LIHEAP or low-income home heating oil program.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that failed. While there was a large number of senators that wanted to see that happen, not enough. And so the problem here is that I think that the oil industry and its campaign contributions continue to buy the oil industry a certain amount of immunity from scrutiny by the United States Congress.
Now, as we all learned in high school economics, it's about supply and demand plus. I mean, here we've talked about the gouging aspect, but to some extent it is supply. And if there's if the world was awash in oil, well, then the prices would be a lot lower. But there's a lot of things that control it. One is how much is actually being pumped out of the ground by the different countries that supply the United States. Is there an adequate amount? Because we always hear about OPEC, for instance, controlling the amount and keeping it at a level that it'll keep it at least at a certain. In other words, it's not controlled by market forces. They're not putting everything on the market that's available. So, how much is supply and how much is it being controlled a factor in what we're paying at the gas pump?
OPEC definitely plays some role, but I think that their influence on global markets is less and less when you look at where the United States gets its oil. You know, only about 14% of all the oil we use every day is coming from the Persian Gulf OPEC member nations. A much bigger share, quite frankly, is coming from North America, where Canada and Mexico combined are the biggest suppliers of oil to the United States. And remember that the United States itself is the third biggest oil producer in the world. Only the Saudis and the Russians produce more than we do. So there really is no global shortages of crude oil. The issue here is the ability of large corporations in some countries to manipulate these markets and make enormous amounts of money at the expense of consumers.
Now, Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, who, as I understand, is pumping out as much as possible at all times, he said that he would be able to provide gasoline if they were to eliminate the middleman and speculators, but he could probably reduce pump prices by $1 a gallon. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. There's no question that Venezuela is a huge producer of oil and provides a large amount of oil to the United States. So that definitely would make a big difference. And he has pledged to give some oil at below market rates to low-income Americans. But the real problem here is with the United States energy policy. If you look at the energy bill that President Bush signed into law on August 8th, it doesn't do a single thing to address any of these fundamental problems. It doesn't do anything to hold oil companies accountable. All it does is provide huge subsidies to oil companies. There's $6 billion in subsidies in the energy bill that go to these wealthy oil companies. There's nothing in there to reduce our consumption of oil, and that really is another big issue here.
Conservation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, the United States uses 25% of the world's oil every day. We use twice the oil per person than do our competitors in Europe and Asia. So clearly, we can do something to improve the efficiency of the way that we use our oil.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, the energy policy, developed by the Bush administration isn't getting the job done.
You listen to Peter Werby's show. My guest is Tyson Slocum. He's the research director with Public Citizens Critical Mass Energy and Environment Program. And there's so many little aspects of this. Let's go to the testimony that these corporate CEOs, the oil company executives, gave a couple of weeks ago, that they weren't sworn in, and they said that they had not met with Vice President Dick Cheney's energy Task Force in 2001, and then a document is obtained by the Washington Post that, in fact, shows that any number of them, ExxonMobil, Conoco, before its merger, Shell, BP America, that they all, in fact, had met with Dick Cheney, and on the face of it, it appears they were lying to Congress.
Yeah, absolutely, Peter. I mean, you raise an excellent point here that we can't really trust what the oil companies say. Here they are, they're dragged before the United States Senate, they're speaking publicly, and they all deny that they ever met with the Cheney Energy Task Force.
And they were indignantly denying all of this, we should say.
That's right. Yeah. And it's pretty disgraceful, to be very honest with you, that they would so brazenly actively mislead the United States Senate. But even worse is the fact that the Republican majority made sure that when the oil executives came to testify, that they would not do so under oath.
Isn't that unusual?
It's very unusual. And I think, again, it shows just how powerful the oil industry is. They've made $54 million in contributions since 2001. 80% of that $54 million went to Republicans. I think that those campaign contributions have bought the industry immunity from adequate scrutiny, and that's proof with the fact that the oil industry executives weren't required to testify under oath.
Mm-hmm.
I've testified before the United States Senate. I did just in September, and I had to testify under oath. So if I'm the director of the energy program for a major consumer organization, if I have to make sure that my testimony is sworn to be true, why can't ExxonMobil and the other CEOs do the same?
Also, listeners, if you'd like to see some of this testimony that Tyson Slocum, our guest, gave, you can go to citizen.org. Citizen.org, another website connected with Public Citizens Critical Mass Energy and Environment Program, is energyactivist.org, and I'll have that on my website, peterwerby.com. Take us back, if you would, Tyson, to 2001, when there was this energy meeting, and everyone suspected, and here's a name it's like almost as far gone in our memories as Monica Lewinsky, Ken Lay from Exxon. And the suspicion was that these energy companies, led by Ken Lay, were meeting secretly with Vice President Cheney and creating an energy policy that would help them greatly, but without concern for the public. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question that energy company executives had a preferential treatment when it came to developing energy policy. The Vice President Dick Cheney Energy Task Force relied exclusively on the active input and consent of major energy company CEOs and their lobbyists. And so it really is no surprise that the energy policy put forward by the Bush administration and eventually adopted into law this August reflects a wish list of energy corporation executives. They get their tax breaks. They get their regulatory rollbacks. They get what they wanted. But consumers who were shut out of the process from the very beginning, we don't get anything in this energy bill. And that's a problem. This is what happens when you only listen to one side of the debate in the United States. And that's what the Bush administration has done on a number of key policy issues. They consistently listened to only one powerful special interest. In this case, it's only energy companies. They didn't adopt anything that really serves the interests of consumers or environmental protection.
You know, I was reminded by someone, I think a listener, that the first act of Ronald Reagan when he came into office on January 20th, 1981, was to take down the solar panels from the White House that Jimmy
That's
Carter
right.
had put up. I thought that was an extraordinary act of symbolism, kind of in league with when he announced his candidacy in Mississippi at the site of where those civil rights workers had been murdered. But is there anything in the energy bill that has to do either with conservation or with alternative fuels?
No.
Okay.
There is really very little in the bill. There are some small incentives to manufacturers to produce some fuel-efficient hybrid cars, but the way that that credit is structured, it discriminates against the leaders of the hybrid car industry, Toyota and Honda, and really is just a handout to the U.S. auto companies that haven't really bothered to make those investments in more fuel-efficient vehicles. There are some other small tax credits, only good for tax year 2006, for homeowners to do some minimal energy efficiency steps, but it's tiny compared to the tax breaks available to oil companies. So, again, you know, there was some effort in the Senate that Public Citizen worked on to get rid of these tax breaks for oil companies that were included in Bush's energy bill. And the Senate rejected Public Citizen's effort. They voted against repealing those tax breaks to oil companies and instead to give those tax breaks to consumers.
Now, oil is an extraordinarily lethal substance unless it's left alone in the ground. I mean, for one thing, we always wind up fighting wars about it or over it or trying to gain it or protect it. But even beyond that, when it's pumped out of the ground, when it's shipped, when it's refined, I think of gasoline refineries, benzene refineries, plastic manufacture. And when it's utilized, of course, there's a poisonous exhaust, and then you have to get rid of a lot of it. So it's something you would think a sensible culture would be moving away from, but it doesn't look like there's the slightest bit of political will within the mainstream. That's my speech. But here's the question. The question is, I've heard it posed that you cannot produce enough alternative energies through alternative sources to run a modern industrial society. Any sense of that?
Well, yeah, that is true. That right now we don't have the capacity to completely replace all of our fossil fuels with alternatives. But the fact is, we need to start making those investments today. You know, the president has been running around the country for the last year saying that Social Security is going to be bankrupt in 40 years. And so as a result, we need to take steps today to plan for that. But at the same time, everybody pretty much acknowledges that in 40 years, we're probably going to run out of oil. But yet we're not taking those steps today to plan for that. So instead of, you know, subsidizing fossil fuel companies like ExxonMobil, which is what Bush's energy plan does, we should be starting to heavily invest in renewable energy and alternative fuels so that we can become energy independent and there won't be a crisis in 40 years when fossil fuel supplies run out.
Tyson Slocum is my guest. He works with Public Citizen on energy issues. Well, let's visit that a little. You said run out. Now, let's be real precise. I mean, it's not like in 40 years from now there's not going to be any oil left. I mean, we're talking about reaching a point of what they call peak production, right? And then there starts to be an increasing drop-off in what's available from sources. But still, I mean, I agree with you 100%. But so there's not a doubt in your mind that at some point we're going to hit the wall in terms of what is available.
Well, yeah. You're already starting to see production decline steadily, and so it's just a matter of time, like you said, where our continued consumption of oil is going to be outpaced by the ability to produce enough. And, you know, as long as that's the scenario, and everyone pretty much acknowledges that that's the scenario, we need to take steps to plan for that today.
Mm-hmm. Among one of my perhaps incorrect predictions over the years has been that the phrase developing nations is a misnomer. In other words, that most of these nations are not going to develop. They're not going to develop into first world production and consumption entities. But, of course, at least I was partially wrong. Some of those countries are mired in third world status and aren't making any progress, but probably the most notable one is China. Can we live on a planet where major population nations produce and consume to the level that we do?
Well, it's definitely not sustainable over the long term. So, you know, that's the issue here, that we have to start planning today for this inevitable shift.
So what you're talking about essentially is not necessarily, although these are important, individual acts like individual recycling. But we got to start talking about some major policy shifts for the entire country.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when our fuel economy standards have decreased from 22 miles a gallon in 1987 to 21 miles a gallon in 2005 because of the loophole for gas-guzzling SUVs, that shows that our commitment to fuel efficiency compared to our competitors in Europe and Asia is awful. The cars on the road today get worse gas mileage than they did 15 years ago. That clearly shows that we can do better. But right now, the policies of the Bush administration has not been to improve that fuel economy standard.
You know, we do these, what we call ascertainment, essentially these surveys to see what our listenership wants to hear about in terms of public affairs programming. And one of the many reasons, Tyson Slocum, I invited you on, is because they want to know about high gas prices. But the lower the gas prices, the more people tend to consume. And wouldn't be if gas was, say, like $5 a gallon. When it was $3 a gallon, I was thinking about twice about making 100-mile round trips, you know, whereas I, you know, if the gas is a dollar and a quarter, I wouldn't think twice about it. So there is something that the price going up actually causes conservation.
Oh, there's no question that it does. The problem is that it results in very, very high prices for consumers and for a lot of people, especially middle and lower income people, who don't have an alternative to driving or to heating their home with natural gas or heating oil. They are stuck having to pay extremely high prices without really being able to effectively moderate their behavior. I mean, you have to use a certain amount of natural gas or home heating oil to heat your home in the winter. If you have to drive to get to work, you have to fill up your tank with gasoline. So as long as that's the situation, I don't support heavily increasing prices on consumers unless you're also providing them with alternatives, whether it be starting to more heavily invest in mass transit or providing alternative fuels or things like that.
What does a public citizen ask, like our listeners and your members and supporters, to do? How can we be effective as energy-conscious citizens?
Well, there's a lot that people can do. I mean, you know, you can try to carpool. You can try to do things to use less energy. But the fact is that we need more tools to help us do that, and that's where energy policy in Washington, D.C. can make a huge difference. Instead of subsidizing producers of energy, as the Bush administration does, we should be trying to subsidize consumers, providing more financial incentives in the form of rebates for homeowners to weatherize their homes, to upgrade their windows so that they're more energy efficient, to replace old appliances with new energy efficient refrigerators and things like that, to provide bigger financial subsidies to consumers to purchase a hybrid vehicle, to make it more financially attractive so that they have more encouragement to use less. The energy bill should have given more money to state and local mass transit systems so that public transportation can serve more types of people for less money, to give more encouragement to people to use that kind of alternatives. But that's not what the energy policy has produced in this country, and I think a lot of it does have to do with the political and economic power of the oil companies and their influence over Capitol Hill.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, as usual, Tyson Slocum. I don't know whether I mentioned that you've been a frequent guest on this show and always give us a wonderful perspective filled with information on energy policy. You can go to citizen.org to get more, or energyactivist.org. I haven't been to that site. I like the sound of it. Tyson Slocum, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Peter, it's my pleasure.
This is WRIF.com. Tired of expensive phone bills? Standard phone service can cost a minimum of $30. And for the unlimited packages, it's anywhere from $40 to $70. After adding all the taxes and fees, the question is it really worth it? I'd like to introduce you to Corecom's new product, Voice over Internet Protocol, or simply VoIP. This innovation allows you to talk to anyone around the world by using your broadband internet connection. With its advanced features, VoIP is revolutionizing telephone service as we know it today. Even more exciting is that this can all be done at a fraction of the price of traditional phone service. Why would you pay more when you can pay less? If you've got high-speed internet access, Corecom can offer you a package for as low as $15.99 per month. When was the last time your phone company offered you any package options that low? As an added bonus, if you call within the next 10 minutes, Corecom will throw in 1 month free. All you have to do is call 1-866-680-CORE. That's 1-866-680-CORE. Call now and mention promotion code WRIF. Or if you register online, type in promotion code WRIF to get your free month. Corecom, revolutionizing phone service, one call at a time.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
Hi, this is Colleen McDonald, president of Holiday Automotive Group. You know us as Holiday Chevrolet in Farmington Hills, Livonia Chrysler Jeep in Livonia, and Century Dodge in Taylor. We know it's never fun to have to bring your car in for service, and worse yet, if you've been in an accident. But rest assured, our service staff is here and ready to help you. To make an appointment, go online at weloveholiday.com. It's that easy.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
We also have special discounts if you need body work on your vehicle and accept all insurance companies. Call us at 866-867-0909 for more information. We're the Holiday Automotive Group. We've got you covered from Downriver to Oakland County.
Get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV, get a car, get a truck, get an SUV.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Riff, then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock rocks.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best Riff Rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Two for Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff Rocks.
more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Good morning. Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby with you. And we've talked a lot over the recent months about the lead-up to the war in Iraq and what its origins were. And, you know, there's been a lot before and since said about its causes. And I always contended, in the main, it was about oil. And we have a guest with us this morning that will speak in part to that, but a broader idea of the role that fossil fuel, and particularly oil, plays in the industrial world. In fact, much of it is in the subtitle. The book is The Party's Over, and the subtitle, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. And Richard Heinberg is my guest. He's from Santa Rosa, California. He's been writing about energy resource issues and the dynamics of cultural change for many years. And he's a member of the core faculty at the New College of California in Santa Rosa. And Richard Heinberg, thanks for joining me.
Good to be with you, Peter.
Now, on the face of it, in fact, maybe we're giving away the ending in a sense, because the party's over, that sounds very ominous. Oil, war, the fate of industrial societies, again, very ominous. And on the cover, very interesting. You know, I looked at that a couple times, and finally, I don't know why, because it really does jump right out at you, a wine glass broken on its side and spilling out oil. So the party's over, but there is, before, maybe I'm just kind of telling people there's bad news, but there's good news as
right.
Well. There's a way out of a way home after the party's over. Tell us what you're addressing, what you're looking at in terms of the problem facing industrial societies.
Well, the problem is, first of all, that we have become, as a society, addicted to a non-renewable energy resource, namely oil. Oil has been the oxygen for the industrial system. I mean, oil has been cheap. It's a highly concentrated form of energy. It's easily transported. It can be turned into plastics and lubricants and fuels of various kinds, everything from jet fuel to diesel and gasoline. And it's just permitted us to rearrange our entire way of life and to, well, I teach human ecology at New College, and as an ecologist, the way I'd put it is it's enabled us to increase the human carrying capacity of our environment. In other words, you know, until 1800, there were only as many as a billion of us in the world, and now there's 6.3 billion, so we've increased the carrying capacity of our environment for human beings by over 600%. And we've done that through increased transportation, transporting resources from where they're abundant to where they're scarce, and by increasing our agricultural production, using tractors to replace oxen and horses, you know, which we used to have to grow food for, and that took up a lot of space, and now we don't have to do that, so all that space can be used to grow food for humans. And we make fertilizers out of fossil fuels, and we make pesticides and herbicides. And when you total all of that up, it amounts to a huge social dependency on this one substance. And we've always known that substance, oil, was non-renewable and therefore would run out someday. But we really haven't made any plans for what we would do when it did start to run out. And unfortunately, we're getting to that point where it's not that it's all going to be gone in a few years, but we're going to get to the point where where demand begins to exceed supply regularly on a yearly basis. And when that happens, the party's going to be over.
And this has already happened in terms of the supply outstripping demand. It's already happened in the United States, of course, and as far as I understand, it's just happened in China as well. In other words, countries that were once oil producers become net importers.
Exactly. Yeah, the U.S. is the classic example in this regard. The United States was the Saudi Arabia of the early 20th century. We were the world's largest oil producer, even the world's largest oil exporter. We won two world wars. Largely, obviously we contributed soldiers who fought very hard and many died and so on. I don't want to belittle that. But largely we won those wars by the fact that we were able to contribute large amounts of oil to the Allies, whereas Germany and Japan lost those wars largely because they ran out of gas, quite literally. So we became the world's foremost economic and military power because, again, partly because we had huge indigenous supplies. But we found out that those were limited in extent. In the 1930s, oil discovery peaked. In other words, after the 1930s, we were finding more. We were finding less and less new oil every year, to the point where now there's virtually no new discovery taking place in the lower 48. In Alaska, some, and offshore, some, but in places like East Texas and Oklahoma, it's all been discovered. Everything that's there has been found, and production then peaked in 1970. And so every year since 1970, we've been drawing less and less oil out of the ground and importing more. So now we're importing about 60% of what we use. Well, the U.S. is the forerunner for the rest of the world in this regard. There have been more oil wells drilled in the continental U.S. than in the rest of the world put together.
So really?
Sooner or later, the rest of the world is going to catch up to where the U.S. is now. And, in fact, elsewhere in the world, oil discovery peaked in the 1960s. So that tells us that the peak in oil production is basically just around the corner.
And we're actually expanding oil use or oil product use, aren't we?
That's right, yeah. And, you know, many people think of oil in kind of using the wrong metaphor. They think, well, when are we going to run out? And if you take the total amount of oil still left in the ground, it's a huge amount. It's like about a trillion barrels of oil are still in the ground. And we're using oil at the rate of about 25 billion barrels a year globally. So if you divide 1 trillion by 25 billion, you get 40. So we have 40 years' worth of oil. But that's, you know, that's asking the wrong question. The question should not be when are we going to run out, because in fact, 100 years from now, 200 years from now, we'll still be pulling oil out of the ground, but in tiny quantities. The question we need to be asking is, at what point, again, does supply start to no longer meet the demand? When does oil production peak? That's an entirely different question, and it's an entirely different answer. It's not 40 years from now. It's more like 4 years from now, sometime between 2004 and 2010.
Well, it won't, to some extent, be extended in a self-regulatory manner. That is to say, as it becomes scarcer and scarcer and production begins to drop, the price will go up. And, for instance, if gas is $15 a gallon, people are going to start driving less distances and probably will, you know, get rid of the SUVs and be back to little, who knows, maybe two bangers.
Right. That's true. However, we're not really prepared for this. You know, this basically happened in a way back in the 1970s when we had the oil embargo from the Arab OPEC countries. And it resulted in a decade of conservation and changing the speed limits from 75 to 55, and people bought smaller cars and insulated their houses and so on. And it worked. You know, we increased our energy efficiency dramatically. But it also took a real hit on the economy. Economists look back on those years as probably the worst recession since the 1930s. And something similar is likely to happen again. I mean, when toward the end of the year 2000, natural gas and oil prices went up pretty dramatically just over the course of a few weeks. And that was really the end right there of the decade-long boom of the 1990s. And the economy is having a tough time pulling out of that tailspin right now, partly, again, as a result of the fact that oil prices are still pretty high. We've created an economy that's based on the idea of cheap energy sources and perpetual growth. But once we reach the end of the era of cheap energy sources, then perpetual growth is going to come to an end as well. It's a different kind of economy that we're moving into, a different world altogether. And as I said, we're just really not very well prepared for that.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Richard Heinberg. And he's written, without oil. No, that's right off the back. The party's over. I was looking at the back of it and looking to see that, gee, I've interviewed some of the same wonderful people that give a good endorsement to your book, Tom Hartman and cellist Glenn Denning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Party's Over is the name of the book. Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies is the title. And it's new from New Society Publishers. You can go to newsociety.com. You know, when there was such an inability of the anti-war movement running up to the Iraq War to actually be able to enunciate itself in any form like the government was. In other words, that wasn't not allowed to any great extent on the media. So it was almost boiled down on the side of the anti-war people to slogans, and although there was a whole critique there. And one of the slogans was "No Blood for Oil," the idea being that the war, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, was about oil, and in many ways it gave forth the impression that these were greedy oil men who wanted to enrich themselves through this bloody war and direct control. And I think, and I haven't gotten that point in your book, that severely misstates what the interest in oil and the importance of oil. Am I correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that, Peter. I don't think that this war was fought directly to enrich Dick Cheney's buddies in the oil industry, for example. I think the people who planned the war actually believe that it's the best thing for the country. Personally, I think they're mistaken about that, but we can get into that. I think there are people who are aware of the kinds of constraints we're talking about, that soon we'll be facing the end of cheap oil. And for a big industrial country like the U.S. that has invested so heavily in infrastructure that's dependent on cheap energy, I mean, we've invested hundreds of billions of dollars in the interstate highway system, the biggest public works project in the history of humankind. We've invested in cars and roads and so on. For a country like this, there are really only two paths once the cheap energy starts to run out. Path A is, use your military, figure out where the remaining deposits of this black gold are in the world, take them over, and use them till they're gone. Now, that's path A. Path B would be some kind of global system for cooperation, conservation, and using what's left to fund a transition to a lower energy, more localized energy regime. And that path B is difficult. You know, path A is horrific, because basically it means war for the rest of our lifetimes. It's not going to start, it's not going to stop in Iraq. Basically, we will be in competition with every other nation that needs energy resources, including countries like China. But plan B is very difficult because it means countries like the U.S. will have to probably give up some of their standard of living, give up some of their competitive edge, and move in a direction of cooperation and conservation, just basically using less energy.
I remember, I think it was Marie Antoinette who famously said right before the French Revolution, after us, the deluge. In other words, that they could hold on to a rotting royal system, and what came after them, she didn't seem to care much about, although unfortunately for her, the deluge caught her. Could that be the mentality in a sense? I mean, the men in Washington running things don't always seem to be the brightest to me, but they've seen this literature. They've seen the predictions, and you draw upon the work of M. King Hubert and the Lundberg. What's his first name?
Yeah, Jan Lundberg.
Jan Lundberg has predicted also of oil coming to a crisis point in 2030 or 2040. So the information's out there, mm-hmm. and one almost gets the sense that if we can just get through, our time on Earth, till 2010 or 2020 for these guys. But the idea to completely alter American society, and as soon, I suspect, I may be wrong, but I suspect as soon as you said lower standard of living, and what was the second thing you said? Diminish the competitive edge. People probably think, not me. What is this guy?
Right. Yeah, we're number one.
Yeah.
And right. We don't want to give that up.
Right.
But, the cruel fact of the matter is that even if we succeed with Plan A and we do take over the world's remaining energy supplies, those will run out. You know, and we'll face the same situation in 20 or 30 years that we might face in 5 or 10 otherwise.
So that's after us, the deluge, though.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but actually it could be so in this case. So in a sense you could almost, and I mean I would like to see us go right to option number two, but you could actually do option one, which is on the boards now and operational, and then all of a sudden say, gee, we're going to have to just start doing a little cooperating here.
Yeah, well, the problem is that that option B, you know, the cooperation and conservation, the longer you wait, the more difficult that option becomes. If we had started the energy transition, say, 30 years ago, after the Arab oil embargo, and we actually did start down that path, as I mentioned earlier, the speed limits were reduced and energy efficiency of cars was increased and so on. But if we had continued with that up to the present, we'd be in a much better situation. Actually, the Arab oil embargo of the 1970s probably bought us about 10 years in terms of time before the oil production peaks globally. If it hadn't been for the Arab oil embargo of the 70s, we would already be past peak, and heaven knows where our economy would be. So the sooner we opt for Plan B, the better off we'll be. Now, the problem is it's not a politically attractive option, and people often say, well, look what happened to Jimmy Carter. You know, he was trying to promote energy conservation, and the message just didn't go down well with the American people because there was a candidate opposite him, Ronald Reagan, who said, well, it's morning in America. We don't have to worry about these constraints. We'll just, of course, Reagan ended up running up the biggest budget deficits in history up to that time. As I was saying, the longer we wait, the more difficult it becomes. And our tendency is to think that there is a Plan C. Plan C would be, well, just business as usual. Mm-hmm. You know, there's going to be plenty. Maybe technology will save us. Maybe hydrogen will come in and save the day. But, see, the problem is if Plan C turns out to be an illusion, which I think it probably will be, then we will put ourselves in a position where there really is no Plan B available.
But I wanted to set this up a little more because I know where you're going, and actually this is an important part of it. I almost forgot this. Our guest is Richard Heinberg, and he's written The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, and it's published by New Society Publishers. You can go to newsociety.com, go to any bookstore, preferably start with an independent bookstore. But the idea is that when you start talking about diminishing the standard of living, right now I drive a full-size Ford sedan. You know, I'm born in Detroit. They made the car in Detroit that I drive. And on a weekend, we might drive up to this area called Traverse City. So it's, on a way 500 miles, 250 miles up there, 250 miles back. The idea, for instance, that I would have to drive some little teeny car is not real appealing. And the fact that I would have to, not be able to drive as much or as far isn't appealing to me personally, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
On the other hand, what we're told is we got to get off this oil addiction and just turn it all over to fuel cells and solar power, have just a big panel on everybody's roof, and boom, we'll be able to live just like we have been. You don't buy that, do you?
Unfortunately, no. The idea that hydrogen fuel cells will power an energy society with the same energy use that we have now, I think, is based on incorrect, not doing the math very well, let me put it that way. The problem with hydrogen is that it takes more energy to produce the hydrogen than the hydrogen actually has. Virtually all commercially produced hydrogen now is made from natural gas, which again is limited in quantity. Production is peaking right now in North America. You can make hydrogen from water using electricity, but it takes more energy in the electricity to disassociate the hydrogen from the oxygen than that hydrogen will have when you put it through the fuel cell. So hydrogen is just an energy storage medium. It's not an energy source. And so that puts us back on the primary energy sources that most of us are already familiar with, the fossil fuels, coal, nuclear, hydroelectricity, solar photovoltaics, wind, and so on. And somehow we're just going to have to sort it out among all of those energy sources that we're already pretty familiar with as to, you know, how we're going to get by as oil and natural gas start to become more scarce.
Well, I guess maybe maybe we try to, in, so now we're just not worrying about people's individual desire for what size car. What
right.
What would a society look like? Would we be in some miserable state? I mean, as soon as you start talking about reducing standard of living,
yeah.
I mean, in many ways, the standard of living produced by cars, the amount of time we spend in them traveling, the amount of money they cost, the damage they do, I guess you could almost make an argument that it wouldn't be a terrible loss, but most of us like our cars and depend on them.
Right, right. Yeah, well, I believe that inevitably we will have to make some sacrifices, but the nature of those sacrifices and how we negotiate them, if we take a proactive stance toward this, will make all the difference in the world. There are a lot of people who feel that the kind of fast-paced, consumer, globalized society that we live in right now is not very satisfactory from the standpoint of just simple human satisfaction. I mean, families get torn apart and live in different parts of the country and can't visit each other very often, and people are, you know, working three jobs to pay the mortgage, and you know, it's just it's an insane rat race that we've gotten ourselves into. And for many people, the idea of living in a slower paced, more localized society where producers and consumers live closer together is a pretty attractive option. I would actually like to live in that kind of society myself.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's traveled much in Europe and spent time in some of the, you know, ancient small villages in southern France and Italy and Greece, places like that, knows that you know, a smaller scale, more localized scale, slower pace of human society can be psychologically and socially very attractive.
Sure, they have even a movement called the slow food movement.
Slow food, yeah. And so I think if we were to take some of the billions of dollars that are currently used to sell us from the day we're age one until we die, every day through advertising, commercials, TV, advertisements that, you know, faster is better and more is better and you can't possibly be happy if you don't have the latest model of gizmo and so on. If we take some of that advertising and turn it around and start reminding people of, you know, what is actually, you know, most important about life, you know, the quality of your relationships, a sense of belonging, of safety, a sense of freedom. I'd be happy to give up some of my standard of living if I thought, for example, that the Bill of Rights was going to be protected instead of, you know, the way we're going right now. People are happily giving up the Bill of Rights so that they can be protected against people from the other side of the world who are angry at us because we want their resources.
Oil.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So look at where that's going. You know, do you want? Is that really the direction that we want our lives to go?
Well, the political will. I mean, it's pretty easy to bash the Republicans. Is for me. In fact, I do it for a living. And, but on the other hand, the Democrats aren't much to write home about either in terms of innovative policy. And both these parties are pretty much tied into the status quo in one form or the other.
Yeah, I have to say, during their 8 years, the Clinton-Gore administration did absolutely nothing in terms of making the energy transition that we're talking about.
Well, so how do we move? I guess I know how we move. It's going to take the people. Like every epochal change that's ever come down the pike, it's been we the people.
That's right. This is going to be a case of the people leading and the leaders following along behind once they get the message.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. There's a lot more in here. We didn't even touch on the history of fossil fuels and how it provided an era of cheap fuel and what kind of expansion it allowed. But I guess that's why Richard Heinberg has written this book. Because,
there's a lot in there that it's pretty interesting, I think.
I think so, too. I'm looking forward to looking through it more. The Party's Over is the name of the book. Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies is the name of it. It's published by New Society Publishers, an excellent source for books, and it's newsociety.com. Richard Heinberg, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure talking with you, Peter.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Every successful career has a beginning. Have you started yours yet? Turbocharge your opportunities by calling ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-903-1919. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech.
If you have an interest in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design, they teach skills that many employers look for. Most programs provide a hands-on education and can help you build your knowledge base and technical skills. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Develop technical skills at an ITT Tech and discover a whole new world of opportunity. Call now for a brochure at 1-800-903-1919. That's ITT Tech, 1-800-903-1919. 1-800-903-1919.
101 WRIF and Media Play present the Free U College Giveaway. Use your MasterCard or complete an entry form at Media Play, and you could win a one-time payment of $150,000 towards college tuition. No purchase necessary. Ends December 31st, 2005. Open to U.S. residents 18 or older. For rules and alternate entry details, visit your Media Play store today or log on MediaPlay.com or WRIF.com. Media Play with locations in Livonia, Utica, Taylor, Clinton Township, and Ann Arbor.
This is WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 482-220.
For a great cause, it's the Rockin' Chopper Giveaway.
Listen for more details or log on at WRIF.com.
Brought to you by Miller High Life, the United Auto Workers, and 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
You let me complicate you.